Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the National Liberty Alliance Monday Night Call. It's Monday, the 17th, on 2016. Thank you, everybody, for showing up. We appreciate it. We have lots of things going on, you know, in NLA and throughout the nation that are going to affect us, and we will be talking about some of that. I'll do a little talk here now and then a Bible reading, and then I'll turn it over to Brent. And then we'll open the floor up for questions and answers. Questions to Brent first, and then general questions after that. John has asked me to take the call tonight, and he's still fighting his thing. I got a little cold. You'll have to excuse me. I'm fighting something too. I guess we're all fighting on every level, I guess. But anyway, I'm going to go ahead and open up with a reading from Psalms 138. Because I think it's good in these times the Psalms are very powerful, and David wrote them, and he had many challenges, just as we do. So, without any further ado, I'll read Psalm 138. Lord, thou hast proved me and known me. Thou hast known my sitting down and my rising up. Thou hast understood my thoughts afar off, my path, my line thou hast stretched out. And thou hast foreseen all my ways, for there is no speech in my tongue. Behold, O Lord, thou hast known all things, and the last of those of old thou hast formed me, and thou hast laid thy hand upon me. Thy knowledge is become wonderful to me. It is high, and I cannot reach to it. Whether I shall go from thy spirit, or whither I shall flee from thy face, if I should ascend into heaven, thou art there. If I descend into hell, thou art present. If I take my wings early in the morning and dwell in the utmost parts of the sea, even there thou shalt also thy hand lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me. And I say, perhaps darkness shall cover me, and the night shall be my light and my pleasures. But darkness shall not be dark to thee, and night shall be light as the day, and the darkness thereof and the light thereof are alike to thee. For there hast possessed my reins, and thou hast protected me from my mother's womb. I will praise thee, for thou art fearfully magnified, and wonderful are thy works, and my soul knoweth right well. My bone is not hidden from thee, which thou hast made in secret, and which my substance in the lower parts of the earth. The eyes did see my imperfect being. And in thy book all shall be written, days shall be formed, and no one in them. But to me thy friends, O God, are made exceedingly honorable. Their principality is exceedingly strengthened. I will number them, and I shall be multiplied above the sand. I rose up, and I am still with thee. If thou wilt kill the wicked, O God, ye men of blood, depart from me, because you say in thought, they shall receive thy city in vain, thy cities in vain. Have I not hated them, O Lord, that had hated thee, and pined away because of thine enemies? I have hated them with a perfect hatred, and they are become the enemies to me. Prove me, O God, and know my heart. Examine me, and know my paths, and see if there be a way in me of iniquity, and lead me in the eternal way. Okay, so we're working on moving ahead a new program of spearheading as far as making answers into the court. Within the next couple of days, it's going to be, you know, when we do it, it's going to be a big mailing. It has to go out to everybody. John has something written. He was going to read it tonight, but he's not here. And I'm not going to broach that. Plus, We have to massage it a little bit more, so probably next week, well, definitely next week, it'll be ready, and it'll be a definite direction. We did not get the number in the court yet, so the next step is somebody's going to go up there. I don't know if John will be feeling good, but one of us over here in New York is going to have to get up there and pay the money and file the paperwork. So all us New Yorkers, we should get together and talk about that and, you know, think about when we're going to go up there and do that, because the sooner the better. At any rate, you know, we're turning over kind of a new leaf by doing this. This really sticks a stake into their underbelly, so to speak. But, you know, we want to do it in a in such a way that we're not being arrogant and we're not being they're gonna target anybody that goes against their New World Order agenda. They're already doing that. They're collecting information. We understand that. I won't dwell on that because look, I don't think that they're going to be as successful as they think they are. You know, I don't know, you know, what's going to happen here with this election and after it, but it's going to be very interesting. And in no small part, things are going to flesh out just the way that God's people allow them to, because by our participation and our prayers and lamentations will be the extent that, you know, we get the help from on high, because that's the only way this is going to happen. If we're all together in prayer, in unison, and a force of one, that's what we need. And so it's coming close. These are going to be exciting times, to say the least. They're going to be interesting, maybe more interesting than some of us want them to be. I don't take that lightly. And so with that, I'm going to go ahead and open the floor for Brent. I don't remember what his subject matter was tonight, but you can give us a little recap, Brent, and go ahead and do your thing.
Thanks. I, again, appreciate you letting me come on and tell people what I have discovered. I should add, it'd be a good idea to add, that the things that I say here are not necessarily the point of view of NLA, although probably in a lot of cases it is. We don't stop to discuss that. We just keep going. I imagine we're of like kindred mind in most things, but I spend my time trying to understand through experience and practice in the courts and reading what the truth of the matter is. We've been talking about the militia. Before I do that, I want to mention one thing. I fought long and hard today about it because it came up so often the last month or so in these Monday night calls about martial law, and the threat of martial law, and is martial law all bad, or is it a good thing? What is the danger of it? And there's some things that I ought to mention that I didn't mention before, although what I said before was good. But martial law, we had said, has a right jurisdiction. It has a place where it should be used. And fundamentally, martial law is just that. It's martial. It should be used with armies in the field. And traditionally, since the beginning of time, it's been used to govern men on ships at sea, and more particularly, warships. It's a military law. It's a law that applies, martial law is a law that applies where obedience to all orders, failure to give quick obedience to orders, could result in death or terrible injury or even loss of a country. That's where martial law applies. And the Bible is clear on that point. The book of Numbers, the fourth book of the Bible, is a book about martial law jurisdiction almost exclusively. And it's the book that tells us more about the militia of the 12 several tribes of Israel and what governs them. And then adds to that also the priesthood. The priesthood called the Levitical priesthood, which of course is fulfilled now. We don't practice those things anymore, but it is instructive to us to know that that was a martial jurisdiction. What does that mean when I say martial? It means this: failure to obey the law, to follow the orders in martial jurisdiction, could result in immediate death. Summary judgment, that means a drumhead court if you're in the army. That means captain's mast if you're on a ship. That means no jury. That means the commanding officer, the man in charge, whoever it may be, he decides who lives and who dies if someone's committed a capital crime. And whether or not one intended to or didn't intend to doesn't always matter. That's the difference between martial law and the law of the land. The law of the city, it's called, and the law of the land. Martial law is a one-man show. There is no appeal, no meaningful appeal beyond final judgment. That's it. That's martial law. We don't want that to happen here. But one of the things I wanted to mention about martial law that I had not mentioned before is this, that martial law is a horizontal law. What do I mean when I say that? I mean that martial law is between men, the relationships between men. As to God, there's no escaping the trespass of God's law, whether you intended to do it or not. The consequences are inevitable, utterly inevitable. God is the God of nature, the laws of nature. You break the laws of nature, you could die real quick. There's no forgiveness there. There's no forgiveness if you jump off a tall building thinking God will save you. In every case, unless he decides to suspend the laws of nature, which I suppose is possible but not probable given our knowledge of history, it's an immediate fulfillment of the consequences of that attempted violation of law. You can't violate law. That's the martial law jurisdiction. But as between men, you know, when God tells men what to do, they better just do it. The example I like to use out of the Bible is Uzzah. Uzzah thought the Ark of the Covenant, the Ark of the Testimony, that evidence-keeping ark, was going to fall off of the ox cart. And so he reached out to steady it, and God killed him because God had commanded that no one touches that ark except those that are authorized to do so and in the way they were authorized to do so. The law is immediate. The consequences can be immediate. That's martial law. Keep coming back to it. We call it martial law. It can be called a lot of things. It's called the law of the city. It's called martial law. It's called military law. It's called the law of the sea. It's called admiralty law. It's called maritime jurisdiction. It's called administrative law, bureaucratic law. All of those are designed to ignore the intent of the party or any facts that may change the way it's applied. And because that is true between vertically between God and men, that is true, then God doesn't want men to play that toward one another. Government doesn't have that jurisdiction except where God says they do, and that, of course, is in military life and admiralty law, where ships are at sea, not to be extended upon the land. And if you go to the Declaration of 76, you begin to see that of all the complaints there, and there are plenty of them, they all come back to the same thing: a denial of the law of the land in favor of the law of the city, a denial of the law of the land, our common law. Because our common law is about our relationships between one another. And when it comes to that, everything's up for grabs. That's why we have juries. That's why we stop. That's why we go through the modest inconvenience of due process before we take a man's life, liberty, or property. We put him before the jury. We allow cross-examination, confrontation of witnesses. We do all those things because we're not God. That's why. And that is our common law. It is not a military law. It's the law that governs us and the processes that God has put in place. Our common law reflects those. And it keeps us mere mortals, wound up and bound up in our own whims and difficulties, regardless of how high the office is. It keeps all of us from unnecessarily dominating and abusing each other. It is the restraint of God upon men, one toward another. Martial law does not apply, except unless we're mustered as one of the members of the militia of the several states, mustered, that's when it starts applying, because it is a military jurisdiction. In America, that would be that a man would fall under, if he's mustered by the President of the United States, that means he falls under the Uniform Code of Military Justice that Congress has provided. If he's mustered by the governor of his state, that means he falls under the legislative code that the state legislature has provided. But in either case, he is the militia. If he's mustered, he comes under that military law. If he isn't, he doesn't. It's that simple. And we've got cases on the books of the U.S. Supreme Court to back up what I've just said. And fortunately, in the cases that have gone up, I'd mentioned before, and there was a lady on that wanted to know the name. I think I got it to her. It was the name of the case. It was in the N. Ray Milligan from Southern Indiana, tried in Fort Ben Harrison in Indianapolis, and sentenced to death. A reprieve was entered, and the Supreme Court of the United States looked at the case and said, no, this man's not mustered as a militiaman. He may be part of the militia, but all men are. All men 20 years old and upward that are able to bear arms, whether they know it or not, they're a member of the militia. And as long as the common law courts were open and he wasn't under military jurisdiction, and both of those things were true in Indiana at that time, right at the end of the war between the states, then he had to have been tried before the jury. He wasn't, and so the Supreme Court of the United States said absolutely not. Well, American limited government under our Constitution is rooted in the Anglo-Saxons' Volk Reich. Volk, the German, Germanic language for the people, and Reich is our word right, R-I-G-H-T. It means duty. It doesn't mean something I get to do and nobody can stop me. We've perverted it into that meaning because we've hackneyed the word, we've overused it. Volkreich, that means the people's duty. The people's duty of what? Of government. And the people are the militia. That phrase, the people, means the militia. The third fair among the Anglo-Saxons, they called it. Volkreich, we now call that our common law, the people's law, because it is the people's duty to govern. They do that fundamentally, most fundamentally, by two avenues. It is the males, able-bodied to bear weapons. Their two duties are foreign and domestic. Foreign, that's armed defense as a member of the militia. Domestic, enemies domestic. That means you're willing to serve on the jury to defend the law of the land. The Volkreich. The assembly of elders, called earls in old Anglo-Dane England, called the Witan, got together, they called them the Witan, that was the body of elders, granted executive authority and power to Anglo-Saxon kings at their advice and consent. There's another phrase they use that's in our Constitution. Granted power to the king only after war, after they had declared war, and therein lies the reason that Congress is given the power to declare war and not the president. These are ancient practices that have come down to us that haven't changed. And our Constitution merely writes them down. Those that drafted and ratified our Constitution did not pull that stuff out of the air from great thoughts and from geniuses. No, they just tried to put in place what had been forgotten. And they said so. And there's never been anything good, by the way, that's ever happened among any people, that there hadn't been somebody, some man or small combination of men, that have reached back into the past and tried to reestablish something that had been lost. And I think I'd mentioned before, because enemy attack can come quick and sharp, the body of elders, called the Witan Gemot, empowered the king in those ancient days to muster the third, that is the militia of able-bodied men, for war without the elders or the Witan's consent. They had standing orders. To get the militia going. Third fair, they call it, the militia going. Of great note, when Bill Clinton became president, he bolted from all previous precedent of presidents, unwritten in our common law, what I just told you, standing orders. All previous presidents received standing orders upon taking the oath of office from Congress, standing orders to give to the Joint Chiefs of Staff of our military so that in the case of an emergency, who knows what could happen, where there's no time for consultation of the Commander-in-Chief, or he's killed or kidnapped or who knows what, that the military has standing orders from the Commander-in-Chief. Every president has done that. Bill Clinton never did. He never delivered standing orders to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which of course would apply also to the militia of the several states if they had been mustered by someone having authority to do it. If not the Vice President, if he was unavailable, then the Speaker of the House of Representatives was responsible to take that position and responsibility. There still is, by the way. Our constitutional custom empowers the President to mobilize the armed forces for war, but before commencing hostilities, our law, our custom, requires that he ask and receive from Congress a duly voted upon declaration of war. And only upon the advice and consent in the ancient days of the old elders, the Witten, the earls, did the Anglo-Saxon kings levy the tax for war called the Dane Gold Property Tax for raising an army. And likewise, American presidents set before Congress their proposals for taxation to support military activities. Then Congress either denies, consents, or modifies at its pleasure. That's our Constitution, Article 1, Section 2, Clause 1. The President of the United States, under that language, is duty-bound to ensure that the military forces of the United States are ever ready, according to whatever means Congress provides. Now, history has preserved minutes of council meetings of kings and earls during the times of Alfred the Great. That's going back to the 9th century. And those minutes of those meetings show forth common law principles of limited government practiced in old, ancient, Anglo-Dane England. And we discover that their practices were strikingly as those our Constitution of the United States lays out and the customs that we practice that go along with it, the common law, of which I've just spoken, the custom of the President in relationship to the Congress of the United States. And when an Anglo-Saxon king died, the Witten, that is the elders, analogous to our Congress, often, but not always, appointed one of his kindred to succeed him. Sometimes they appointed somebody else. There was no hereditary crown in Anglo-Dane England, just as there is no hereditary executive office in the United States. We're coming dangerously close. The Bushes are a bad precedent, and we're discovering now that they are not who they have presented themselves to be for three generations. Many people have known that, but now it's widely known who they are. And now we're talking about people that, for conveniences of politics, are married, and the wife of one man that was in that White House wants to be in the White House, too. A very bad precedent. Hereditary, family, cronyism, nepotism, to use the fancy word, relatives, all patting each other on the back and gathering power as they go. Well, regardless of the king's pedigree in Old England, the Anglo-Saxons limited their kings. Common law is limited government. And the kings in Old Anglo-Dane England before the Norman invasion were extremely limited, and our Constitution and our form of government, the common law, according to the first of our Supreme Court justices, James Wilson, is our attempt to hark back, reach back behind the Norman invasion of 1066 AD and reestablish the principles of common law government as they stood in those days when the Anglo-Saxons controlled England. Well, the kings were appointed at the Witten's pleasure, just as the Congress of the United States ultimately has the power to say yes or no to the President, to veto his actions. And then the Senate has the same power that pertained over 1,000 years ago under our same tradition. The Senate has the power to consent to the appointments of the President, appointments to offices, judgeships, and they have the absolute right to advise the executive branch as the President as to what he may be thinking about doing and raise Cain about it if they don't like it. That's their duty. And in the ancient England also, the folk law, the Volkreich, our common law, empowered the Witten, that is the elders, the earls, to impeach and remove the king and appoint another. And no, that was not the case in the rest of the world, never has been. The power of impeachment is a common law doctrine, impeaching, removing. We do that because we're a common law country. Lest we forget, the rest of the world does not do that. They have a lot of other things they put in place, but ultimately it's all, even if it's there and it looks like our impeachment, it's pure window dressing to give the people the feeling that the government doesn't have as much power as it says it does. Doesn't have as much power as it, yeah, to give them the feeling that as it says it doesn't, but really it does. I said that wrong. The first principles of our common law government found their way into the United States Constitution, authorizing presidents, for example, to wage war, negotiate, and enter treaties, make certain appointments to office only with the advice and consent of the U.S. Senate. And that, by tradition, by the way, a tradition, comes down to a majority vote. But there's nothing in our law that says that has to be so. The Senate can do what they want. I've read the Senate record. I got involved one time trying to find out how the certain federal judge got on the bench. I read the record, and I saw that they couldn't get a second to get a vote on the man to the floor to okay his appointment to his federal judgeship. Not only could they not get a majority vote up or down, 51% of a quorum, they couldn't even get the motion on the floor to get the vote. They couldn't get a second for it. Never did. And there he was sitting on the bench. I said, how can this be? I examined and re-examined the records. Dick Durbin had argued for him to try to get a vote, a second on the motion. All they wanted was a second. They couldn't even get that. Carol Mosley Braun, she argued vehemently, almost cried because they couldn't get a second on the motion to get it up for a vote. Nonetheless, there he sat on the bench, giving people life sentences, one right after another. His first name was Mike. People called him Maximum Mike. He always gave the maximum sentence. Well, I finally came to the conclusion after reading the record that after, of course, they tried to get the vote, and then there was a big hiatus in the record, a big blank place, and then it said confirmed. There never was a vote. But as long as the Senate of the United States, the records, the official records, say it was confirmed, that ends the matter. No one can call their hand. They are the exclusive judges of their own proceedings, our Constitution requires. And separation of powers requires any other branch of government from ever questioning or looking into what they do. They don't have to say anything. They can do whatever they want. Always keep that in mind. It doesn't always have to be a bad thing. Sometimes it is. Well, back to our militia. Militia of the several states, the four militia clauses, that's been the subject for the past few months. The ancient nation of Israel accounted for every able-bodied man by name, family, and house to serve in his tribe's militia. The 12 tribes of the nation of Israel in the book of Numbers, by the way, it's called the book of Numbers because twice in that book, the entire militia of the 12 separate tribes of Israel is numbered by the head. Once coming out of Egypt, they were numbered, and they came out, by the way, in ranks, armed ranks of five. That's the specific language there. 603,550 exactly men numbered in the militia of the 12 tribes of Israel coming out. Every one of those men except two perished 40 years in the wilderness because they murmured against God. And then, before they entered the land, the militia was numbered again. It was over at that point. All of those had died 40 years in the wilderness. Every militia member was 40 years old and under. And at that time, all of them, none of them had come out of Egypt, but they were purified, in a sense, purged, roughened, tough as nails, used to obeying orders, even when it didn't make sense, like marching around Jericho seven times. Well, those militiamen, just over 601,000 of them, went into Israel. And the requirements of the book of Numbers that delineate the law of the militia in great detail are analogous to our militia of the several states of our Union. And, by the way, also, that book Numbers became the foundation of our first fathers, not our founding fathers, But I'm talking about our first fathers. Of course, our founding fathers followed in their footsteps. Our first fathers were the Puritans, and the militia they established was founded upon the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God, the common law of England, and the Bible, the common law supplementing the Bible. The Bible was their legislation. They took it for their legislation exclusively. They had no legislatures. They formed no legislative bodies. They took the law of Moses for their legislation. And if you like to read those kind of things, you can go look up the early court records of Massachusetts and Connecticut. Any good library will have them, and the case law and the opinions are there, just as they've been ever since in the other publications that have kept track of those opinions and case law. Those are substantially have remained, those first principles have remained ours ever since that day. Well, during those early days, somebody asked this question not long ago. During those early days, I'd answered the question. Somebody said, what about the man that's in a motorhome and he drives around the country? And is he part of the militia? Well, of course he is. Every able-bodied man is part of the militia, whether he understands it or not, whether the law says it or not. Even if the law says he isn't, he still is, because that's the law. That's fundamental law. It can't be changed. But he's driving around his motorhome, flitters from place to place, here, there, and yonder. What's the law? What's our common law? Our common law forms our Constitution at every point, our four militia clauses. Well, the law, the common law, had always been, I said 40 days. It wasn't 40 days. It was 30 days. If a man stays in any particular local militia jurisdiction for 30 days or more, law would have required him to enroll his name upon the rolls of the militia of that place. There's no rule that says a man can't be a vagabond. If he doesn't stay in any one place long enough to require him to put his name on the roll of the militia, he can do that. But if he does stay there 30 days or longer, at common law he's required to inquire and find out with what person he is required to report to put his name on the roll of the militia. That doesn't mean he can't leave if he wants to after that. He can. That's the law. Our common law is a very non-stringent law. It doesn't seek to control men. It just seeks to draw some lines and say, we need your help if you do certain things in exchange for you staying here 30 days and enjoying the benefits of our community and the protection of our laws. We want you to put your name on the roll in case of an emergency. We may need you. That's a balanced approach. Both the Bible and our common law recognize that as long as the individual is free to arm and train himself in the use of weapons, his bearing of arms for defense of his home, his family, his neighbors, and his country remains an insurmountable safeguard against tyranny. According to the Bible and according to our common law, each local militia unit chooses its own officers. Our Constitution's militia clauses require that the officers, the federal government, cannot appoint any officers within the militia of the several states. That's all done locally. That means state by state, and the states can dictate how they do that, but the states cannot abrogate, that means turn over, that responsibility to the federal government, to the president, for example. It is a non-delegable duty. It's non-delegatable to anyone else because the law drops it directly within the jurisdiction of state government and how they want to do that. Further, all understood at common law that each man provide his own arms, that means his own gun, that means his own military-grade weapon, at his own expense, and also provide requisite marksmanship and safety training with that weapon, meeting the standard that the state legislature under the militia clauses is supposed to set for that state, so that each militia member, when he comes of age, I like to say 20 because that's what the Bible says. In early America, they didn't follow that real close. Sometimes they said 16 and 50. But at any rate, at a certain point, a man becomes a man. He becomes responsible to get a job, procure the money, somehow get a military-grade weapon that meets the requirements of the state legislature of his state, and then get the training that's required, and then familiarize himself with the weapon so that it is a useful tool in his hands and is able to do his duty. I want to say this again. I'll end with this. I've repeated it several times. It bears repeating. We must keep reminding ourselves the right to keep and bear arms is not a right as Americans understand right. Never was. We perverted the meaning of the word right. It's a duty. It's not an option. It's a duty. Self-preservation, preservation of one's family, defense of one's neighbors, if need be, and their property, and of one's state and one's country, is not an option for an able-bodied man over 20 years old. At the least, it's a duty. Well, the individual right to keep and bear arms is part of our common law tradition, as expressed in the Statute of Winchester, the Second Amendment to the United States Constitution, all many of our state constitutions, and the other three militia clauses of our U.S. Constitution. Don't be intimidated, not even a little bit. The Second Amendment is the fourth of four militia clauses. The militia clauses of our Constitution are the law of the land. And the common law that informs those, because those militia clauses are short, they're brief. Our Constitution is a brief of common law government set in, as our Supreme Court says, compact draft. It doesn't define things. It doesn't explain things. It doesn't expound anything. It merely states what it is, as our courts have continually observed. Our Constitution is a spiritless, lifeless document, a disconnected collection of dry bones. Without our Constitution to breathe, our Constitution without our common law to breathe life into it. That's all I have this evening. Thank you, Gerard. And if you want me to stick around, people want to ask questions, I can do that a little bit, and I'll tell you what I know about it. If I don't know, I'll say so or pass it off to Gerard.
Okay, thank you, Brent. I'm going to open the queue up so people can get in there so we can do this in an orderly fashion. Let me see if this thing will slide. I don't know, it's not letting me. You know what? I think I got to go in lecture mode. Brent, if I lose you, get back in there because I don't think we ever went into lecture mode, so I think I have to be there before we can do that. So here we go. I'm going to put it into lecture mode. And if you want to ask Brent a question, specifically for Brent, then get in the queue, and we'll call on you. We'll give people a couple of minutes to get in there. Well, we got Georgia, Eric from Georgia. Let me unmute you. There you go. Go ahead, Georgia.
Okay. I was wondering if Brent could say where in the Bible. I'm sure it's a few places, and you mentioned Numbers tonight. But where in the Bible it says that we have the right? And he was talking about this. Where specifically in the Bible, and now, of course, the right as it's been perverted, but the duty to protect ourselves, our family, and our community, where in the Bible this is, and I know he's mentioned before the part where Jesus says, you know, if you have to, give up your raiment or your overcloth to acquire a weapon. And I was reading some other fellow's take on that, and he was saying that, well, Jesus didn't really mean you should defend yourself, because further on in that passage he talks about there being only two swords, and since they were up against a lot of the enemy, two swords wouldn't really be realistic. Anyway, it just sounds like a bunk private interpretation to me. I think it means more like Brent says it means, and that Jesus was saying you need to be prepared to defend yourselves. And if you have to give up your overcoat or your raiment, you need to give it up to get a weapon. Anyway, I was wondering if Brent could talk about where in the Bible, and I'm sure it's a few places, you can find that. Please and thank you. Did we lose Brent?
I think we have to unmute him. You know, I went and left.
I'm back now.
Yeah, there you go. Okay.
Yeah, I'm back. Let me mention a first principle of interpretation of documents of legal significance. Now, these principles you can find reiterated over and over in the opinions of the Supreme Court, because they interpret our Constitution, they interpret statutes. You can find it in the federal district court opinion. You can find it in state appellate court opinions. These are, and you can find it in the Bible, by the way, demonstrated, illustrated. I'd say probably among, there's a couple, just a couple of principles of interpretation, if we follow them, proven, and by the way, affirmed by Holy Writ. If we followed them, we'd go a long way to not having as many differences as we have about things like our Constitution and the Bible especially. It's one of those books that everybody thinks they're an expert in, whether they are or not. And understandably, I want, and other people, it's right that people do approach the Bible and interpret it for themselves. That's what's made us a strong nation, really the only nation in the history of the world that's ever made that part of our culture, that every man can take his Bible and decide what it means. That's fundamental to us. But a principle of interpretation, though, would help. Just a couple I'll mention. One of them is that every word must tell. Every word must tell. Let me put it another way. There are no superfluous words in writings of legal significance. We presume that when we approach them. Now, when it comes to statutes, that's not always true. They're very badly drafted sometimes. You approach it that way, but if you can, you want to make it make sense. You want to interpret it in a way that the whole thing makes sense and not nonsense. And that's where our Constitution should be approached, and our Supreme Court has said so. Every word must tell. There are no superfluous words. Don't leave any words out and say, well, that doesn't really matter. It's kind of a weak, meaningless word anyway. No, it has to be getting full force. But the second one is this. This seems to be a more pressing rule that's forgotten. It is this. Where the Bible or the Constitution or a statute or any law, where it speaks clearly on any particular subject, where it's unambiguous, clear as crystal, then all other statements on that particular subject must be understood in conformity with that clear statement. The habit of most people is to take clear statements from our Constitution or from the Bible and say, well, yeah, it says this here, like the one guy you just cited, but over here it says this. So what people did do is, well, I think we should take these two and put them together and water them both down, and then we can accept them. No, that's not true in interpreting statutes of Congress or state legislatures. It's not true in interpreting our Constitution. That's not the way it's interpreted, and it would become senseless and be why it's done sometimes, I have to say. And when that happens, everything becomes watered down, compromised, and meaningless. So when it comes to, for example, do we have a duty that's God-given? That means that's what we call a fundamental duty. We call them fundamental rights. That's a fundamental duty. Do we have support from God himself that we should defend ourselves, defend our country? And I would cite you to that passage in Luke. I don't remember exactly where. It's in the 20s. Maybe 20, I don't remember exactly. But it's a passage where Jesus Christ says to his learners, his disciples, he said, when I sent you fellows out the first time, did I send you out with a money bag and a traveling bag and go with a gold and silver coins? Tell you put gold and silver coins in your money bag. And did I send you out with a heavy coat? Or did I just tell you to go out and rely on people that support what you're doing? And they said, well, yeah, you just told us to go out, not take any of those things. Rely on people And he said, yeah, I said that. But then he said this, but now the one having the money bag, let him take it. And likewise also his leather travel pouch, let him take that. And the one having not the sword, let him sell his cloak and buy one. Now I'm reading from the Winterized version of the Bible, the Winter's translation. And I found it while I was talking. It's in Luke 22, verse 20. I lost it again. Well, Luke 22, verse 36. For indeed, he says, verse 37, I clarify to you that this which stands forever written must yet be perfected in me. And then he quotes the Bible, the Old Testament. And then verse 38, he says this, and they said, Lord, behold, here are two swords. And he said to them, that's enough. Two swords are enough. Now, it seems clear to me that he's sending them out again. He's approaching his fulfillment of the law. He fulfilled the penalty of the law for his people. He gave his life, God in flesh, in human flesh, with an infiniteness that we don't have. He gave his life and raised himself from the dead and paid the penalty for our sin. That's an old word that means trespass of the law. For our trespass of his law, of God's law. God himself paid the penalty of his people for trespassing his law. Unfathomable truth. But Jesus Christ here does not speak with any ambiguity, clear as crystal. Yeah, that was true back the first time I sent you out. But now as I approach giving myself over to brutal torture and death, to be stripped naked, beaten to half to death, and nailed to a wooden post, he said, now things are changed. And by the way, we're in that age. That marks the change. The change of the modus operandi of God respecting men and those that follow him. And when Jesus Christ comes again, he will not come as a suffering servant. He will come as a warrior, and he will annihilate anyone who looks at him even with hesitation. He says that. The brutality of his command of the armies of the Lord will be perfect, it will be total, it will be terminal. But right now, he's saying to us, he's not saying to us, go out and annihilate people. That's not our job. And I can show you where it says that in the Bible, too. But right here, I want to focus on this. Right here, it's clear as crystal. He's telling us to go out and defend ourselves. I'm reminded of John Knox. I've told this story before. Please let me tell it again. If you've heard it, just bear with me to prove this point. John Knox was a Scotsman. He is the spider in the nursery rhyme of Little Miss Muffet, who sat on a tuffet eating her curds and whey, and along came a spider and sat down beside her and frightened Miss Muffet away. Well, Miss Muffet was the stepdaughter of a fellow by the name of an insectologist named Dr. Muffet. He lived in Britain. And one of his specimens was misplaced, apparently, and she sat down on her little stool, her little tuffet, to eat her cottage cheese, and she saw the spider, and she ran away, and it reminded him, he saw this, and it reminded him of something that was in the gossip of that day, because it really happened. John Knox had been outlawed from Scotland by Mary, Queen of Scots. But he was so well known, so beloved, he came back. He knew nobody would try to kill him, and he told Mary, Queen of Scots, he sent word to her, he said, I want to talk to you, and I want to talk to you right now. He went into the castle at Holyrood, and had a meeting with her. She said, I fear John Knox more than all of the armies of Europe. And John Knox, of course, had become fearless because at the command of Rome, he was committed, captured, an iron collar was put around his neck, and he was stuck in the bottom of a French warship as a galley slave for 4 years. And death was no stranger to John Knox. But John Knox, his first job upon his conversion to Christianity, in its primitive form. His first job was to carry a claymore. A claymore is a Scottish broadsword. That's what they call them. Still call them that. It's one of those kind of swords, I like to say, they used to use to make personalities out of people. Clay means great, and sword, more means sword, a great sword. Well, he was a long-legged galoot, and the reason they called him the spider, and that was his nickname, was because he was a galoot. He had long, bony fingers, and his arms were, I don't want to say he was a knuckle-dragger, but he, in proportion to his body, it looked a little unnatural. Well, a man that has arms like that, the natural weapon is a broadsword, because like a boxer, it's hard to get close to a fellow if he's got a sword, and then add to that the length of his arm. Well, he stood in front of a man during those early days by the name of George Wishart. Very kindly man. The priest eventually burnt him at the stake for his kindness. But his job, Knox's job, was to stand in front of him with his claymore so that people wouldn't kill George Wishart while he taught the Bible. Seems kind of funny to us today, but that's what he did. And these fellows, what I'm trying to say is, these fellows understood this passage. And when you go read the writings of John Knox, he's alive. And clearly the man was a firebrand, but he wasn't dumb, and he understood more about the Bible and more about the Greek and the Hebrew and the Aramaic of the Older Testament than the professors we have in our colleges and seminaries today that teach it. But he understood this passage. This passage is clear, so all understandings, this is one of the clear passages, there are others, all understandings that may be ambiguous to somebody, to interpret the Bible aright, must be understood in light of this clear passage on the subject. But I could show you other clear passages too. Take the calculus, for instance, of all of the book of Numbers. And the militia of the 12 tribes of Israel, who stood and encamped in formation, always in the same formation, according to tribe, and their banners flying around the tabernacle, around the court of the tabernacle, always in the same place. And even when the tabernacle moved, the militia of the 12 several tribes of Israel stood up and marched in that formation with the tabernacle as it was packed up and moved, and the Ark of the Covenant, which was the safe box for the evidences of the land deed of Israel, and it was guarded that way. And also, of course, the militia of Israel was the thing Moses feared, and he told God that he was afraid of them. Well, that's the way it's supposed to be. Our leaders are supposed to be afraid of an armed populace, the people being armed. Now, that's one example. I would encourage you to examine that. Read that over and over again. But now, that is the turning point. That is the turning point of his process of how he wants us to operate. And he tells us right there, get a sword. Not for dominating other men. No. Not for conquering other countries. No. But for defending yourself while you're doing what God tells you to do while you're following his law. He wants us to be self-sufficient. He says here, take your money bag. He says, take your traveling bag. Be self-sufficient. Have a way to protect yourself. There's more than one way. I can tell you, I knew a fellow once, and all of his ability to protect his family was stripped from him by the federal government. And the only weapon he had left was to not tell the federal government the names or the addresses of his children and his wife, because he knew they'd come after him, try to rip the children away from the family using the local DSFS or Department of Family and Children, whatever, the people that take children and move them into traffic and all that baloney. Well, so it was the only weapon he had. They said, well, we're not going to let you out of prison unless you tell us. He said, well, I'm not telling you. And he was slated to get out. Well, he never got out. What did he do? He remained silent. He has a weapon. He used it to protect his family, and he did. He wrote it out. Finally, he got loose under other circumstances. But to do what God tells us to do, we have a duty to protect our family. The Bible says if you do not provide for your family, well, how can you provide for your family if they're dead or raped? It says you cannot, he says you have a duty to provide for your family, and you're worse than an unbeliever. The old word in the King James says you're worse than an infidel. Sounds like something from Islam. But worse than an unbeliever. You're a bad man. And how can you protect your family, I say also? How can you protect your family if you don't first protect yourself? All the Quakers were wrong on that point. You protect yourself first, if you have to, if you have to. Then you protect your family. Then, if you can, you protect others. You protect those that God's given to you closest, for closest responsibility first. Oh, yeah, that's clear as crystal. God is not pleased with men that allow others to abuse their families. Not at all. Anyway, that's my answer. I hope that helps. And that principle of interpretation, that's Luke chapter 22, verses 35, 36, 37, along in there.
Yeah, that was excellent. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for the question.
Thank you, Brent. We got Jeremiah coming up. Go ahead, Jeremiah. You're unmuted.
Well, thanks a lot. Brent, I hope you're well. Gerard, I hope you're well. Good. Everyone on the call, I hope you're also well. I guess, Brent, I wanted to ask you, well, first of all, I want to just comment. It's not really a question. There may be a question, but tonight, my friend, first of all, I want to say something. Sound Signal, Bob from Indiana, has been a big-time supporter of you. And I've talked to him, and I watched some of your videos because of him. And listen, you showed me tonight something that I had not known before about the right to bear arms.
Uh-huh.
Let me ask you a quick question. Does a non-citizen have the same Second Amendment right if they're here?
Well, sure, a non-citizen, according to common law, and we have to hark back to that because Congress and the state legislatures have abdicated their duty and not spoken. So a non-citizen who's here has a right to, or has a right, that's a duty, has a duty to enroll himself and be prepared. Yes, he does. And who would be foolish enough to say that every man doesn't have a duty to protect himself no matter where he is with the means that God has given him? Because God gives man life, and when he gives man life, and life is a property right, for crying out loud. You can't separate property from life from liberty. All three are the property rights, and all three are part of life. They rise and fall together. We can separate them for purposes of analysis. Movable property, chattels, yes, yes, we can do all that. But every man is given life by God, and when God gives life, along with that, with every jurisdiction, that's a right, is the duty to protect it. Protect it. That doesn't mean you go about dominating other people, hurting other people, no, but if somebody threatens you, you have a duty, and I'm telling you, we're forgetting these fundamental things, and because we're forgetting them, we're not protecting our other rights either, our property. How can you live without property? Food is property. How can you live if someone steals your food and you don't have much? We're coming down to that, people talking about that more and more with all of the rumblings we hear. It's every man's duty to protect his
right.
life. And you know, a fiduciary duty would demand that you protect the life of another before your own. I said a while ago it's important to protect your own life, but that is with your family. That is only protect your life so that you can protect theirs. But there may come a time when you need to give up your life to protect the other fellow if you have that relationship with that person that demands that kind of fiduciary duty. You know, the Bible says that Jesus Christ, no, it says it this way, it says the Lord, that is Jesus Christ in the Old Testament, he is the member of the Godhead, a member of the Godhead. It says that God keeps his promises even to his own hurt. Even to his own hurt. And who gets the benefit? Well, we get the benefit. That's who gets the benefit. And Jesus Christ did just that. He kept his promise to death, torture and death, to his own hurt. Because it was his fiduciary duty. He took up a fiduciary duty. What's a fiduciary duty? That's a duty that says that I have to do my duty toward the other fellow with whom I'm in this fiduciary relationship before I take care of myself. I get the burden. He gets the benefit. God took the burden. We get the benefit. God died for us. God died for us. Took on the form of a man. Died for us. We get the benefit. We get no burden. Isn't it fascinating that all false religions, they're all the same. In those religions, men die for their God. In Islam, you die for Muhammad. They don't call him God, but he is. He's the mediator for them.
Hey, thank you. Yeah. I just want to thank you, man. Thank you for your answer. I appreciate you.
Okay. Yeah, thank you for the question.
Okay, thank you, Brent. And with that, we'll take any other call or anybody else that has a general question. I don't see that we have any more for Brent. So if you want to get in the queue, now's the time. There's nobody in there.
I have a question, Gerard.
Yeah, go ahead.
That was in reference to the last information paper. By what specific law is the media required to perform their First Amendment duty and report or print a copy of this information?
Are you asking me or are you asking Brent?
I guess this is Brent's, but we ran out of Brent questioners, so I just tossed it out as one of the sentient questions for tonight. Anybody?
Well, I'm not sure what white paper to which you refer, I guess, so I wouldn't...
So one of our filings, Brent.
Oh, I see. What does it say?
Depends on which one. In other words, John usually adds a little ditty on there that the media is required to perform their First Amendment duty and report a printed copy. See? Now, what law says that that is so?
Well, I wouldn't think that the private media has any real duty under the First Amendment. The First Amendment limits government, doesn't limit the private media. We get worked up over the media, and we say, and I haven't looked at the document, so I'm not making a comment about the document because I don't know it, but just in general, we get upset at the media. We say they're biased and all that. Well, of course they are. That's what media has always been. You know, we have these old newspaper and other papers at home that were named during the days of the war between the northern and the southern tiers of the states, and they're called the Union and the Democrat and the Republican. Well, those kind of papers, of course, were when they weren't trying to hide it in those early days. They supported a particular political point of view, and if you didn't like it, you didn't have to read it. Well, things haven't changed. It's just that we've added the ruse, we've allowed the ruse and of some kind of a media that doesn't have bias. It doesn't exist, never has. Matter of fact, they're viciously biased, always have been. The only reason anybody would want to get into owning a newspaper or a media outlet would be to get across their point of view. It's called freedom of speech. The media has a duty, maybe it's unwritten, to get the word out, but there's no law, really, that says they have to do that. You know, we got into this thing a number of years ago. I was on the radio back at that time some, and it was called the Fair Use Doctrine, or the Fair Something Doctrine. If a radio station interviewed a fellow that had one point of view and he didn't try to seek out and offer that an opportunity to the contrary point of view, the FCC could come along and shut him down. And it was an unbearable burden for people, guys running stations, to try to do that. I knew some of them at that time. Well, they finally scuttled the idea. They don't do that anymore. That was back not too many years ago. They're talking about it. I hear rumblings about it coming up again. But I'm just talking about general first principles again. I'm not making comments about the white papers. I would agree, of course, that, and I would be upset if the media doesn't try to be a little bit fair. I want them to be, but there's no law that says they have to be. And I don't really want to live in a place where the media is forced to be fair, because then you run into the question, who's the media? You know, we're putting across our point of view tonight. Are we the media? I'm on the radio 6 days a week, 3 times a day, 5 days a week. Am I the media? I'm not paid to do what I do. I don't consider myself the media. I don't have a media card. And I don't have the rights that maybe the big-time media people have, but I don't want someone to come along and say the media has to be fair and balanced, like Fox News has said about themselves. Well, that's just a promotion. They're not fair and balanced. And I've watched their viciousness just like I've watched the viciousness of CNN and National Public Radio. Well, that's just a comment. That's all I've got to say about the subject. Gerard, do you have something you want to add?
Yeah, you know, I think that was called Equal Time. They used to do it during the... They still have laws on the books in a campaign. If you give one candidate so many minutes that they are bound to give another. And it's all tied into the corporation, too. The same thing with this business with benefits that the media enjoys. You know, when your government gives you benefits, there's always strings attached. So the medias, they got these media cards. They can go into the crime scenes. They'll let them in where you and I can't go as a rubberneck, you know, looking for something. If you got a media card, they'll let you into the crime scene. And that's a sort of a benefit. Now, do they have to do that? I don't think they have to, although they're a public official doing things in public, and it behooves, you know, the powers that be to be open. And one of the ways to be open is to let the media observe them and question them, especially, like, let's say, at a crime scene. But I think you're right. There is no law. The only thing that comes up is if they're biased or they're printing, you know, if they're ruining somebody's reputation or putting lies out there. But that's no different than you or I doing that. We have to answer for that, too. So I agree. But, you know, I know that there are certain things that they get, certain benefits that they get. And the government tells them if you're going to take these benefits, then you have to do, we expect you to operate in this way or that way. Now, I don't know how that broaches on legality and constitutionality. You know, I'm sure a little bit is all right, but I could see that going the wrong way, too. You know, they can control it. Then they could say, well, we're not going to honor your paper's media card because we don't, you know, you don't do the things we want you to do to get that benefit. So I think that's where a lot of that comes from, and it's the same thing that we're up against in the courts, you know, as far as the benefits that the government gives and the pound of flesh that they exact for it. So, yeah, but I don't believe there's any specific law. I'm sure you're right on that one.
But you make an excellent point, Gerard, about the benefits, and I'm sure that I know for a fact that non-profit corps, radio stations, for example, under non-profit corps, they're controlled through those corporations. And if you're a big corp, like the big media outlets, the government's going to come along and say, well, you're a corporation. There's certain things you have to do because you are. The scope of your powers has to be here, here, and here. If you step outside of it, we're going to tell you what to do. And I'm sure that figures into it.
Right, right. You know, there's another point I wanted to bring up that kind of goes along with that. You know, a lot of times they put in, like, the Judiciary Act, and they take rights away, and they make them in writing, and because they're in black and white, people say, well, it's the law. But there's something else that goes on, you know, I've discovered in these different acts that they do that violate our rights. If you read through them real carefully, you can find the clause that they put in there that is your redress. And they hide it, but it's almost like if they didn't put that in there, there would be no contract. You see, a contract has to offer things on both sides and equal things. So if the government's going to come in and do a sneaky contract, they have to throw a bone in there someplace because they want to make sure that it's constitutional. Well, if they didn't put that bone in there, it wouldn't be constitutional, but they hide it. And the Judiciary Act has something like that in there, and it says that the people have a right to redress in common law. That's in the Judiciary Act. That can kill the whole thing. If people knew that and they rested in that, that would be the end of that act, because everything else they're doing is just fiction. And they're pulling you into a fiction, and they're presuming you're a fiction. But if you have a right to appeal as a man, as the face of a man under common law, they're done. They're finished. Because that law, which is in the land, supersedes everything they're doing, which is probably admiralty or you know, whatever fiction they're operating under. So I just thought that was pretty interesting that, you know it's the same thing like the income tax. And the way it's written, if you look at it on its face, people say, well, it's unconstitutional. No, it's not unconstitutional. The things they're doing to get you in there might be fraud, but, you know, the way it's written, you are contracting with them. You're sending in W-4s and 1099s. You're reporting on yourself. So by doing that, you're contracting with them. And they give you benefits too. Don't forget about that. There's lots of benefits attached to that to get your obedience. You know, so, and they tell you it's voluntary, but try to volunteer out and see how you do. The trouble is if you're letting an information report go in that says that I am a taxpayer, well, their law says that if you send anything in here that says you are a taxpayer, we can hold you to the tenets of this law, which means we can even jail you for not following it because that's the contract. And people don't understand that. You can't have your cake and eat it, too, when it comes to the government. There's always strings attached. You know, you swallow that, and what they do is they get you to live in the flesh. And once you do that, you remove God from yourself and you're theirs. You're a soulless body, and now they've turned you into a thing. And that's where they feel like they can do anything to you because you're not a man, you're a thing, you're a fiction. And so they sleep okay at night because they figure, look, you did it to yourself. And I think that's, you know, that protects their conscience if they even have any left. Anyway, I don't want to beat that to death. I just want to get that out there. Thank you, Brett. Okay, we have, let's see, Montana Julie. It looks like you're unmuted. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I just had kind of a question about the website because I've been having trouble getting on to do a habeas corpus. It won't let me on the site.
It won't let you on the site?
No, it won't let lets me, it won't let me into, access denied is what I'm getting.
Oh, yeah, what are you doing? You're clicking on the smiley face and it's not going. Is that where you're going to?
Yeah, to the habeas corpus.
Yeah, I don't know. I'll have to find out. I know that John didn't want to. We're not doing any more habeas corpuses, but I don't know that that doesn't mean that you can't take it up to the affidavit place. You know what I mean? Which is, I thought, was what we were going to do, leave it open so you can get your paperwork up to that stage, but we weren't going to run them through the courts right now because we're so backed up with all this other stuff that we have to get through. You know, when we get in the courts and we get one case in and one habeas corpus, then they'll all come flooding in. So I would say, and I'm pretty sure that that's the way we were working it, was you go through and you follow those first steps and fill that stuff out so when the time comes, you're ready. You know, right. I mean, if you got a case, it's a good idea to do that anyway. Affidavits are important, and I think our little thing there, you know, if you follow it, you'll be in better shape, but it doesn't mean that we're going to run it through. It means that you're going to have it ready to go at the time we can go through. So I don't know. I'll find out more. I don't know particularly. I'll have to talk to one of the guys that's more tech about it than me.
Okay. Okay. So I got a call from somebody that's in federal prison, and so I think I have a pretty good case here, but I need to figure out how to proceed and how to help him. So I've been talking to him on the phone once a week.
Right,
so
right.
Do you have any other suggestions for me?
Well, you know, we've done the habeas corpuses that we do and that we have done in National Liberty Alliance. We did them as the tribunal, as the common law grand jury. But the first one that was ever done that John did, he did it himself. It's just a different perspective. And he did it. What it is you, if you fill out habeas corpus the way they want you to, you'll be denied. If you ask the judge, he's not going to give it to you. So you have to learn what a court of record is, how to open it up, and you go ahead and you rule yourself. You know what I mean? You grant it yourself, and that's what we did. And actually, they defaulted like, I don't know what it was, 4 days or a week, and then they let the guy go, you know? And so we can find out more about that. You can learn about the habeas corpus and how to fill it out, but it has to be done in the venue of a court of record. You never want to ask them, you know, if you go into their court arguing their particulars, you'll never get out and you'll never win. You can't argue in their administrative courts because they have a presumption on you that you cannot beat in their court. It's that you're done. Right. You're not even a, you're not a person. You're a thing, and they don't have to offer you anything. And that's the reality of it. And you can't tell me that these judges at a certain level don't understand that. They do. As a matter of fact, I know they do because I've seen them get nervous when we came in. I saw that. I saw the judge get nervous when he let the guy go that John was in there. I mean, they had him beat up and stuff because they were mad. But nevertheless, they let him out. And I also saw in the Dean case where the judge changed his tune when he realized what he was up against. So, you know, they know what's going on. They understand when the people come out that there's certain things that they should be doing. So, yes, if you educate yourself, you can write them, and you may have some effect with it. I don't know. You know what I mean? We've seen it. But we've also seen an awful lot of stubbornness and ignorance and grandstanding on their part. And look, if everybody would educate themselves and go in and file, what do I want to say, good paperwork, not crazy paperwork. You know, lawful stuff that's respectful, and that, you know, most of the time when you get somebody that's in common law and they're studied, I've heard prosecutors and judges be impressed with these people and comment on their paperwork and appreciate it, you know? And so that's what you want to do. We want to be more professional than them when we go on. We want to be more knowledgeable than them. So,
yeah.
If you want, so in other words, what you're looking to do is be the next friend of the guy, because he can't file it because he's in jail, is what I'm assuming. Yeah, and you can do that. Right. There is a way you can do that. You got to educate yourself on the habeas corpus, and you got to educate yourself on court procedure and the law. And, you know, you can talk to, I'll talk to John and stuff. I don't know if we have any examples. I mean, we got examples of habeas corpus that we wrote that you could use. You know, but you're going to have to change it around because you're going to have to come from the perspective of the court, of the sovereign, so to speak, right?
Yeah, I've done some of the training that we've been doing on the habeas corpus. So I just need to do some more, keep it up.
Yeah, you need to brush up, And it's not, you know what, it's not really that hard once you get your mind around it. You know, once you start thinking along those lines, it comes more and more naturally as you go along. You have to train yourself not to think like a slave, because they got us so used to a knee-jerk reaction of obedience. And what we don't realize, by obeying them, you're giving them jurisdiction. You know what I mean? You're giving them authority, you know?
Right.
I mean, really, most of what they're doing is immoral, and we should be abhorred by that. And that's how they're getting away with Sharia law, because these people are coming in and say, hey, you're operating a Christian court. We're under our beliefs here, which are fundamentally different from yours, and you can't force us into that. And they went, oh yeah, I guess you're right. The only thing with Sharia law, though, is in this country, you can't violate common law or natural law. You're not going to be putting people to death and doing some of the crazy stuff. That doesn't go in this country. You got to go, you know. And so, but as far as anything else that they do, look, at the Amish have their own courts, and they put themselves in them and they abide by them, and we don't get in their way. You know, I mean, it's wrapped up in a type of law and a type of religion, and it's perfectly lawful in this country for them to do that amongst themselves. You know, and actually with this whole Sharia law and them pushing their own courts, this is an opportunity for us. Now we can go in and say, look at you guys, you're not Christian. You're taking God out of the court. You worship Baal and Beelzebub. And so I can't be in your court. I want a Christian court, and I want a jury of Christian people. And guess what? They can't deny you. We have to learn how to push that now. That's, you see, if we get a lot of people coming in, where are all the Christians? Where are all the, this country was founded on those biblical principles. So where are all those biblical people demanding their biblical courts? You know?
Yeah.
And we've been asleep too long, because when President Bush signed the order to kill the habeas corpus, that there should have been a cry that came up. There wasn't a whimper. And nobody said anything, you know. Nobody said anything. Nobody did anything. And I mean, I speak to myself first, but there were people greater than you and I that should have been saying stuff. I don't know why. What was, you know, look, at they had us in shock and awe, and that was the problem. You know, we were like the deer in the headlights when we lost all those rights under 9/11. That was a real coup d'etat on their part. But anyway, I don't want to get too long on that. You kind of understand where I'm going with that, so.
Yeah. I have one other question, too, about the website, because I've been doing the constitutional studies, the course, and I'm at the very end, but it won't let me on to the last module there. And so it's kind of going in a, you know, circle. It's, I start to go in, and then it pushes me back out or something.
Well, the one that could help you with that, I think, is Carl.
Carl,
you
got
to try to get Carl Appel. Carl Apple.
Okay.
Appel. He's listed there, and I don't know who else does technical stuff, but something's wrong, and I don't know exactly what it is. It's probably something stupid, but I don't know enough about the tech part of it, you know, as far as getting in. I know that, you know, there could be even just a period out of place or the way you put the answer in, or it could just be a glitch on that particular thing, so.
Mm-hmm.
Give
well,
a
I
call.
Got all the way through it, and I'm having trouble just the last, very last one. So
yeah, and I think there's a tech. There's also a, if you have trouble, there's a number to get a hold of our tech service, and you can do that too. Because if you're sure you're putting it in right, and it's definitely a tech problem, I would just call them and run it by them and see what they say, and let me know. Let Jan or I know if you don't get resolved, because you know, look, we don't want to leave you hanging, and certainly if, you know, we don't want a problem that everybody could be having and we don't know about, so,
yeah,
you know, follow up with us. If you have a problem getting in and it doesn't get resolved, make sure you get back to me or Jan. Try Carl. Carl will give you more help than I will. All I can do is make noise with you, okay?
Yeah, okay.
Okay, okay,
all right.
Very good. Yeah. Thank you, Julie.
Thank you.
Yeah. Let's see. We've got Jeremiah again. Go ahead, Jeremiah.
Hey, thank you, Gerard, for unmuting me. That's really, really kind of you. You know why? Because I really wanted to respond to that last caller and with regard to the habeas corpus. First of all, I've been doing particular and specific research into habeas corpus. If anybody wants to contact me, I'm going to give you my email right now, and I will send you a bunch of information. That I've been to the law library. I shouldn't be doing this. I shouldn't be giving you this, but I'm going to do it because I want to help people in this country. You guys sound like some... The last caller sounded like she really wanted to basically help us for her scenario. The point I'm trying to make is this. I'll send you the information. My email is... secondsonofdonald@gmail.com. Second, that's the number, like, second, S-E-C-O-N-D, sonofdonald@gmail.com. It's basically like a habeas corpus checklist, if you will. But the primary thing that I've learned with regard to habeas is that you are suing somebody when you do a habeas corpus. It's not that you're just putting some filing into the same case, but habeas is actually a separate and distinct suit. It's completely different from the criminal proceeding. It's a civil proceeding. And that's probably the biggest piece of information that I could share with you to give you a better understanding of it on this call. But with regard to Brent and the Second Amendment and the right to bear arms, I just want to send one more real big plug to you and all the work you've been doing to get this information out there to everybody about their ability to be able to bear arms, because the bottom line is this, in the situation of martial law, right, it doesn't matter if the state comes knocking and says, will you bear arms for us? And you say no, well, then you're going to be held in a FEMA camp. Take care. Bye-bye. The bottom line is you have a duty to bear arms, and Brett is absolutely correct. Back to you, Brent.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Jeremiah.
Yeah, we appreciate that, and appreciate Julie's call, too. Good to hear from you, Julie. I didn't have any more to say about it. I thought he said it really well, Gerard.
No, that's good, yeah. So I just wanted to make one comment. He's right. Habeas corpus is just not another court paper. They call it the Great Writ for a reason, because it's the Fifth Amendment due process that's been statutorized, and it's a good statute. That's why they did it. Of course, now they want to get rid of it because they don't like it. But yeah, it stands alone, head and shoulders above, you know, probably all the other court papers, because really, with a habeas corpus, you can't proceed until it's been answered. So it's a due process paper. You know, by what authority, what cause, you know, bring the body, why are you holding it? That's all stuff that needs to be answered if it hasn't been, you know. So are you pursuing in the law or at law, or where are you, you know? Anyway, Georgia, Eric, you've been unmuted. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. So you were talking about the Amish and their practicing. There was a few things I wanted to bring up, but the Amish and they're practicing their own law, and I don't know much about, like you and Brent and John, but it seemed to me when I was looking at the Constitution and studying it through the NLA course, that this seemed to me, and I thought it was pretty clever, to be what I think of as a Christian catch, and that no matter what law you, or no matter who you worship, because you can, you know, it's freedom of religion, but it seemed to me that there was a Christian catch in that no matter what you worship, no matter what it is, if you run afoul of the common law, and if we are enforcing the common law like we should be, then the common law will slap you down because you're not allowed to run afoul of it. And so the Christian catch in my mind is that no matter what you do, you're still going to live here in America by Christian principle because it is a common law nation. So you can worship anything you want. However, it's going to be in accord to the common law, because if you run afoul of it, you're going to have problems. Is that a correct assessment on my part?
You're absolutely right, because that's the highest law that we go by. And don't forget, like Brent says, some of these things actually bode from natural law. You know what I mean? That they go without saying, and our whole premise of our country is under those principles. And so they take, look at, you could do what you want as long as you're not violating the public peace, you know, do unto others as you do yourself, right? There's three tenets. What's the third one there? But those are what take precedent. In other words, just because you're under Sharia law, nobody's going to go out in the street and stone their wife for adultery. We don't do that. And we will not let anybody else do that. We don't care if it is part of your religion. It's not part of, as far as we're concerned, that's unlawful. Right?
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, cool. I appreciate that, because I wanted to make sure I had that right, because it makes perfect sense, really. But then you were talking about the media as well, and them being derelict of their duty. And I think, you know, John mentions how they are, and that, you know, eventually we're going to take their licenses away. And I think he harkens back to JFK and that speech he gave to the press and saying, hey, you guys need to report this stuff, because this enemy, they, you know, there's not guerrillas by day, or it's not armies by day, but guerrillas by night. And they're, you know, they're never called out on their stuff, and they have all the resources. And so that the media has a responsibility. And, you know, I think Brent's a big fan of the Federal Farmer. I love that guy. I think he's like the most unsung founding father that we have, because no one really knows his name. I think Samuel Adams is like that too, except, you know, for being on the beer can today. But
who,
Yeah, exactly. He talks about, I think it is the federal farmer. He says, he talks about how, I think it was in Massachusetts, how they were already manipulating the media, even back then. You know, this is during the time when they're having the arguments for the Bill of Rights. And he's talking about how they're already suppressing the truth back then. And he mentions how what it should be is for trade and farming and commerce. And then you look at the media today, and, I mean, it's idolatry, it's graven images. And don't we have a duty at some point? And shouldn't, I mean, aside from having this card and the benefits, I mean, couldn't even the grand jury go ahead and insert themselves wherever they wanted to and report that way? And there's got to be some remedy to this utterly lawless and deceitful media. And they should, don't they? I think they do have a duty. Why don't they have a duty?
Well, first of all, if they have a license, then that means they're controllable. If you can revoke their license, what's a license? What's the license? A license is what? Usually a license is permission to do something that would normally be illegal. So I don't know what kind of license they have as a media and as print, but certainly if they have a license, it's revocable, and they can lose their charter or whatever. Like, the papers are different than the news media. This new technology is a little different, but they're starting to morph into one because papers are going obsolete and media and video kill the radio store. You know what I mean? So that's where we are. That's where we are today. You know what I mean? So, you know, it used to be the FCC, you know, you couldn't have lewd stuff, cursing on TV. They watched everything. That's because they were holding them to the premises of our law, of our common law, which is part of the Ten Commandments, right? And mm-hmm. and they held the media to that. So maybe that's a good thing. If the papers are going away and the media is going to take over, well, we have precedent where the FCC would look at the profanity and whether or not you're going to affect the morals of a minor. I mean, you're putting this stuff out on a TV that anybody can get with no controls. Obviously, you want to control this stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And, you talk about the Kennedy talking about, you know, the media and enemies by day. But what about, I think it was Rockefeller who met with the media and thanked them for keeping everything secret or they wouldn't have been able to get this far. You remember that speech?
Yeah, I heard reference to it, but I never heard it.
Yeah,
no, I never.
It was at a press dinner, and look, I'm shooting from the hip here too, and I think it was David Rockefeller, and he thanked the media for all the work that they did and how they kept their mouth shut, because if they would have reported to the people the things they were doing, they would have never got anything through, like they, you know, as far as the UN and all these other different things that were put in, and probably the 10 platforms of the Communist Manifesto that are in place in this country now, a lot of that is because the media didn't report it. Just like I said, when George Bush signed the paper and took away habeas corpus, there was not a whimper. But why? Why?
Yeah. Well, you know,
because nobody screamed about it. The media killed it.
Yeah. You probably heard this, but there's a quote from a member of the media, and he's at some function, and he's talking about how they're all bought and paid for, and they're all a bunch of whores. And this is from the 1920s. And, I mean, you can multiply the whoredom exponentially since then. You know what I'm saying?
Well, you're right. But the fact of the matter is there's nothing new under the sun. And that pulls the argument away from people that think that the Constitution is an archaic document that doesn't apply. These things don't change. You know, men don't change their feathers, their colors. You know, I mean, they still have envy, jealousy, and hate, and that's been all through time. And love is in there too. But we're men no matter what. We haven't morphed into angels. You know what I mean?
Right.
So the same things affect us as back then, and our forefathers actually lived through, were smarter than and more learned than the average person today, and they lived through these horrible things. They were students of history, and I think it was Jefferson said, "I know no other way to judge the future than to light the lamp of history to light my feet of which direction to go." Because you're gonna look at history repeats itself. It does, and
that's all it does. It seems. Yeah.
Well, especially if you're not studying it. Hello?
Yeah.
You're going to repeat it because there's all those things that make men tick and are in there. And we make the same mistakes over and over again, which I hear is the definition of insanity. So we should take a lesson from that.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, okay. I guess I should give the floor. Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks, Eric. You're good. Okay. Let's see here. Harley.
Hey, Gerard.
Hey, how's it going?
Hi, Brent. Hi, everybody. Listen, I had a thing on this media deal, and that is that, you know, the media drove all the old white guys crazy, too, you know, like Jefferson and Adams and this and that, and they tried Alien Sedition Acts. And, you know, then the Fairness Doctrine fell apart, you know, like Brent said. But, you know, there's also this abject contempt for telling the truth and being held to being telling the truth. And I say that there's a room for a certain amount of slander law, and the fact that they control the Department of Justice, they control the judiciary system, I think is the only thing that stops those torts. But the people have a tort against liars who use their incredible influence like the mainstream media does. And they run the switches behind the scene, as we saw today, where they cut RT's banking in England and Julian Assange's internet connection in London. One of them. I'm sure he's hardened himself and has, you know, multiple things.
Well, yeah, it's cops and robbers when it comes to
it's
that.
Symbolic. It's symbolic.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, but I was emailing around some of you big guys here in NLA today because a big thing has come across my radar, and that's I've been watching this guy, Leo Stratton, for a little while, and his skill at uncovering these evidences that are, in my opinion, the kind of stuff I'd like to see NLA filing in federal court or whatever. Like, I'm not sure what we're filing specifically where, but I can point to examples of them doing it in Britain under the Crown Court and especially Crown Prosecution Service and a special investigation. They've got a guy named John Patterson and Gordon Bowden. And the reason that's significant to any of us is it's the same group of criminal bankers running LIBOR and every money exchange in the Fed and all this, and they're international investors. And they play this roulette wheel with fake mining companies and futures in, you know, the stuff of the earth, everything from water to minerals. So my point is this. First of all, for people to look at Leo Stratton's work, he was in Portland. They're coming to the end of that the defense resting and the, you know, the final stuff next week, I think, on that. And he was out there Sunday going through the evidence. And it's blatant, and it's connected to people right now in Congress. And these people could be removed. And the media could be held to at least not lie about it. The shit that comes out of their mouth is absolutely 180 degrees off from what's going on 90% of the time. And where are the cases that we can file? Maybe through the NLA, just for truth. We're not asking for the Fairness Doctrine. How do you define it? You know, somebody's got to run the station. They've got, you know, advertisers. They've got an audience. They're going to have an opinion. You know, anyway, I yield on that, and I'd love to hear y'all's comments.
That's good. As a matter of fact, I got that email, and I didn't get a chance to look up Leo Stratton, but I did go in. I started to Google him, and, of course, on YouTube, Dateline, their Dateline made a statement. They don't like him very much. Portland, Oregon. Just when you think you've heard every liberal loony idea for, and then Leo Stratton uploaded a video. I'm gonna go in and see what that's all about. But look, I don't know if I'll tell you what. It's been a while since we sent our first paper out. But the most powerful paper that we sent out was that Coruanto. And if you go through and read the Coruanto, that actually opened up a case. So I don't know if John wants me pointing in that direction, but that's where we're going. And I don't need to say too much. You should go read that and then talk to me after you read it.
Oh, I have. I love that piece. And well, it's funny that one spoke to me out of a lot of the different ones remaining prescient.
Well, that's probably the most important one. And when you file a Coruanto, that's an open court case. So what do you think we're not going to put that back in when we get the number?
Because exactly. And I think we need to start hanging this on people and then having some action items. You know, we could all be just like they call the jails and they call about the Portland Patriots, you know, and everybody out there, and they put pressure and they bring witnesses in court, which also just, you know, it changes the behavior. It's like an observed science experiment is different, you know, just the consciousness being there. But the consciousness being on the fact that we have, as the NLA, call them out, we have a pending court case that we can, you know, drag through a federal court and then slam into the Supreme Court if we get a chance. You know, this is, I think we can rally the whole nation right now at this particular moment where they know whistleblowers are being shut up and they know that the Departments of Justice and Chancery Court dinks over there in Limeyland are doing the same thing, and they, you know, imported that system and imposed it on us with these secret societies. I love the ball worship and Satanism, like, line that you came up with. You know, I can't be in your court. It's not my people. Who are you?
Yeah, well, I stole that. You know where I got that from. But anyway, that's true. It's true. You know, and you know, I mean, I don't know how many of them actually openly do it, but there's too many of them on the high end that are openly doing it. You know, so.
Well, anyway, I really want John to talk to Leo Stratton. I think they're on a level together.
Uh-huh.
And I think he has ammunition and that John has the machine. You
right.
know what I mean? Like he's got the
right.
Gatling gun. You know, John's got the Gatling gun, and this guy's got the bullets for Frank's
Well, look, at we are going to pick certain things that are, you know, this is going to be more like a targeted sniper hit. You know what I mean? So we want those things that can go in there and make the most amount of difference in the least amount of time.
Well, it's absolute outright larceny, fraud, and collusion, and it's just going to burn a hole in them like a brand. I mean, they're not going to be able to escape it unless they hide evidence, throw it out, refuse it, bar it, you know what I mean? But if we have these kind of action items, you got the attention of the whole Patriot community out west. People are ripped about this like they are the pipeline and stuff. And we get a campaign of calling and joining NLA and going to court cases and, you know, piling on. That's all I can think of these days. You know what I mean? Because then we've got something to say, well, there was a, you know, there was a judgment and the U.S. Marshals can go get some people. But up until that time, We're just rubbing sticks together in a closet somewhere. I don't know.
No? Right, right. Well, you know, when tell her I'm on the call. It's Anne. When our cases start showing up on the docket, that's when they're really going to get scared. Because you know, as when they hide them and they don't put them on the docket. You see, once they're on the docket, the people that care, that are reading this, that are active, and they can read it. You see, when you go in these courts, you got to go in with a force of people. And it doesn't take that many. It just takes a tireless minority to light the brush fires in people's mind. And what is the number of that tireless minority? I don't know, but I'll tell you what. If we had five or six people in every courthouse that would go in and make a stink and push papers through, they would be besides themselves. They wouldn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. And if it's on the docket where you could go in onto Pacer and read it, and they're getting, I think they're getting nervous because we had a couple of our members on Pacer, and what Pacer has done is sent them, you know, they were going in and looking at stuff but not buying the paper necessarily. Well, they're sending them all of a sudden at the end of the month these big bills, you know what I mean, like $1,500. See, so they know we're trolling Pacer. And you know, if they send a couple of bills and then you got to fight it, they figure they would probably quell us. You know what I mean?
I don't know much about PACER. Is that case law?
Well, the PACER in the federal court, PACER is where you go to read the docket, the daily, you know, whatever's going on in the court. You know what I mean? It's like the transcripts. But you know, if you want to print them, you have to buy them, and it's like 15 cents a page. You know, but of course, there's thousands of pages. But when they were going in there and looking at them, there somebody over there in that court in that particular in Oregon in this case, they see us coming in, and they've sent some bogus bills. You know what I mean? And I gotta believe that this is designed to cool our jets, so to speak, right? Because now they got a bill, they're gonna close them down, and they gotta fight. Now they gotta go fight with them and say that's a bogus bill. But you know, how long does that take when they're controlling when they're the judge, jury, or an executioner of it, right? So if they can effectively close you out of there, right? So that's an issue. Can you hear me? Did I just get muted? Hello? Hello?
I can hear you.
Okay, because it got really silent there. Okay.
Sorry.
That's all right.
I might have been talking over you. My only point was that we can be not understanding the do-nothing advantage where we might have it, you know, to be minimalist, or we might be missing an opportunity when we should have gotten something in, you know, like when you object early on so that you're not contracting instead of realizing that you've been drug all the way through it and you didn't even have to. But
yeah, look, the time is ripe, and we should have had stuff in there a while ago, but circumstances beyond our control didn't let us in. And whenever that has happened to us in the past, most of the time we figure out that it was good that we didn't do what we thought we should have been doing, that we've been kicking ourselves in the butt because we weren't able to do it, which is where I'm at right now. There was, you know, look, there was a lot of things that got left by the wayside because we just weren't able to get them in there. And we didn't get the number, and we, you know what I mean? Yeah, and just circumstances that didn't allow us to do it. And all what I will tell you is early on when we went to courts, especially when we didn't know how, you know, what we were doing all the time, we'd make stupid mistakes, but we were bold. We didn't let it, you know what I mean? We went in there in a way that nobody else ever did, almost to the point that they would call us contemptuous because we spoke with authority. We were tired of this baloney. We were the people, you know? Sometimes we dropped the ball because we didn't understand the court rules and things like that, and we felt really bad about that. And then later on, we went back and visited, and we said, well, what about this or that? And it's like you dropped that rope over the edge, and then we went back and picked it up and pulled on it. And what we found out was they put that rope around their neck. When we pulled on it, we got them. You see, and if we hadn't dropped it, it wouldn't have went around their neck. So sometimes these things have a silver lining. I'm trying to see the glasses half full rather than half empty. But it's happened on numerous occasions. So I'm hoping, you know, we thought the time was right before, and maybe we missed a window of opportunity on some of this stuff. But maybe not. Maybe not. We got some great people coming out with some great things. And like you said, the timing is right. This is going viral throughout the world. Never mind the nation, throughout the world. All the countries. It's a new world order. They're going after everybody.
Well, I've tried to use discretion on my case, thinking that, you know, if I'm just pretty careful, I can put the nice leave, you know, like when you're on the pool table, you're shooting for the next shot, you know.
Right.
And, you know, this is what I wanted to discuss in private some point, but out here for all of us, do you have any examples of people using of good court documents for a federal case against mortgage? Because that's kind of where we're moving all those, you know, habeas corpuses that were involved with mortgage, you know, show me the evidence, show me the title, this kind of stuff. Can you point us of common lawyer Brent or Gerard? examples for that.
Well, I'll tell you on my end is there's people that have had some successes that we got to go through their stuff. I haven't even been able to examine it. We had one guy that, you know, he had like three successes. We got to go in and see what it was that they, how it was that, you know, they had success. You know, and it may just be the circumstance. Every case is of its own. I can't give you a specific circumstance. And, I mean, John's documented some of the ones that worked. There have been some where they worked. But it depended on who the mortgage company was and the place where they're at. Everyone's a little different, you know what I mean? I don't know if you can carby copy them for your case, you know what I mean? But you can certainly learn from them, you know what I mean?
Right. Right, and that's exactly what I'm trying to do with the England stuff, because it's such a parallel. It's such an incredible parallel. They have common law lawyers who've been working for 15 years to get, you know, this forensic evidence of these shell corporations with all these, you know, wealthy people, not just the elite of Europe, but, you know, all over here too, and all the same characters. But it becomes abusive to the truth tellers. You know, they run all kinds of scams on them with the CPS and the kids and the psych people and just, you know, everything to embattle them. But they keep going back. And, you know, now you've got fraud, cover-up, abuse, suits and claims on top of claims, because not only do they, you know, refuse to answer, but then they do harassing tactics and other stuff in the background. And so we take some hits, you know, throwing ourselves in the cogs of the machine. But, man, we can't be shy. We've got to get our work together and get these things out and get more of them out in mud on the wall, I think, right now. And I'm just saying this loud and clear about these mining companies and Hillary Clinton and all that uranium and other stuff that they think they're selling that, by God, they're not. And we need to call them up by the short ones on it. And we got the whole crowd of people that will rally behind these and probably join NLA. So anyway, I'm going to yield on that, make space for some other sort of things. But
yeah, we got a pretty full queue, so we'll move on. But what I do want to say is we were following some guy that was from Canada, and he was having good success in the courts. And they're under the Queen's Court, but they're actually under Rome, under, you know, if you, their highest law is canon law, because they have something, you know, where the Pope was still involved in their government. But nevertheless, they got that common law from England over there. And he said, oh, I would never go to court in America. You know, it's actually easier. We're in Canada and in England, their common law is a little softer than ours. You know, they're over here.
From my experience, I've been listening for 9 months pretty keenly.
Well, they've been brushing up. They've probably been following our cue. You know what I mean?
Only a few are breaking through, man. You guys are neck and neck, and I'm telling you, we need to work together as the Five Eyes common law country civilization. But anyway, just put a capstone on it.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Okay, thank you, Harley. Okay. Let me see. We have a VoIP dialer here. John.
Hello.
Yeah, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Who's this?
This is John in Alaska.
Okay. How are you doing, John?
I just wanted to say one thing at the outset, and this is not to express any animosity at Brent, but I think self-defense is common sense. If it's oneself, one's family, or defense of the innocent, I just personally don't like the element of force in the equation, where it is expressed as a duty. It tends to detract from the concept of a free man and with a free mind. That's all I want to say on that. And if anyone has anything they want to express about it, that's all right. I can listen. But otherwise, I would say that I think earlier I heard you, Gerard, just make a brief statement or alluding to the powers that be treating people like a thing. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Which would be, and this probably better be stated as a question, were you referring to the all caps name by chance?
Well, yeah, because look, they're a corporate fiction, and they put you into a corporate fiction because the judge is allowed to do that because that solves his problem. And now he can deal with you as a that's why they can do to you what they do to you, because as far as they're concerned, you don't have the judge says the Constitution won't be in this court. Well, she's absolutely right, because you're an imbecile. You got a lawyer to take care of you because you can't argue for yourself. You're like a lifeless body. You're just an empty shell. You know what I mean? You gave up your morality. You went into their system. You know.
I quite agree with what you're saying there, but just because they have made this arrangement with the Syndicate Trust situation, and supposedly through the old captain, you become a corporate franchise to the federal corporation, etc. It's all based on fraud, since you have not been informed of it and you did not give your consent, which brings me back to the situation that I have mentioned to at least four different people, Brent being one of them, that this is a crime that is most prevalent against the American people. And the American people, of course, unless there's some reason otherwise, they are we the people, as expressed in the preamble of the Federal Constitution of 1789, as well as all of the state corporation. I mean, they may be corporation incorporated on the state level. However, to not be unconstitutional or not to be deemed unconstitutional, they put that same type of preamble in their constitution as well. Very well did they, but enough to give themselves a little protection in the courts, I suppose. But the point is, they are required to do that because otherwise it would be repugnant to the U.S. Constitution, and very obviously so. Now, since we the people have been acknowledged by the federal Constitution, well, not only acknowledged, but our predecessors, as we the people, created both the federal and the state constitutions, and so we are the posterity to it. And with that having been said, the crime that is most prevalent against the American people is that of identity theft. And what would be the most efficient manner in dealing with this would be a class action lawsuit with we the people being the plaintiffs and the guilty parties, whether they're corporate courts or whatever, being the defendants. And I would like to get that out to the membership to think about that. And that's basically what I wanted to say this evening.
Okay, thank you for that. And you're
absolutely... I could pose one other question just for curiosity. There's a question in my mind. Must each and all corporations have a charter by which they operate? The reason I ask that is I've been told by the local government that they do not have a charter. Like as though they have just been created. They are a corporation, too. But is this something that can be dealt with,
That's a very Interesting point. I never heard that. That they don't have a charge. And the thing is they create. Look, they're the controllers of the corporation to fiction. That's why they can control it, because they create it, and they can control what they create. So if they're a corporate fiction overlay over top of our government, why don't they have a charter? Well, their charter is supposed to be the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, but it's not, because they're not following that. They put a corporate fiction in. Meanwhile, if they had a charter, it would say it would probably say to usurp the Constitution. You know what I mean? If they got to tell the truth. So I guess they couldn't figure out how to make a charter. I don't know. You know what, what's
their
up
whole,
with that?
Their whole operation is repugnant to the U.S. Constitution.
Absolutely, absolutely. And look, as far as a class action suit, look, when the way I'm working on, we've been working on rebutting all this baloney that they put on us. And I don't want to talk too much because I got some new information, you know. But the fact of the matter is like what our core want, though, we're going in as the face of the people. Look, if they have a fictional face, the government. They have a corporation. They're Invicto, and they're putting you Invicto. So when you go into court, you got to go in as the man, as the person, right? But you go in as the face of all men. You're not just arguing for yourself. You're arguing for the rights of man. And you see, that's where you bring them back to the fundamental principles. And they have to give them that.
Gerard, may I say something at this point? When we do that, we need to be extremely careful that we don't divorce ourselves from our property, because what they have done is to also incorporate our property so that they make the official owner of the property the all caps name. And
they're not saying that in open court. I would love them to say that in open court. Boy, wouldn't that wake the country up? Well, you got a caps name and we own your property. Boy, you talk about a revolution or a civil war right there. But you're absolutely right.
That's right. Look at any tax bill, it's the all caps name.
That's right. That's right. And then when you try to do it another way, you know, when you're writing papers and stuff, and they'll actually complain about it. You say, why? Well, because we don't do it that way. They don't ever give you a good reason. You say, because, look, at the guys, the minions don't know why it's in all cap names. But the guys up there that are sitting in those seats making the decisions, they know. They've been trained. And they've been told. Look, I had a buddy that just graduated the police academy, the state police academy, and they're telling these guys, when you walk up to the car, you're contracting with the people. Why are they telling them that? Why are they telling the state troopers when you walk up to the car? You know why? Because the state troopers don't have they're not a legal law. They're a private police force. They're a corporate police force. They have no force of law under the Constitution.
Right, right.
So they have to contract with you, so you give up your rights so they can beat you over the head.
We've got to be very careful what we do under scenarios like that. Otherwise, we might end up dead because these people are, as the expression goes, useful idiots.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't argue with a cop on the side of the road, but it's good information. Look, when you go to court, that's what you argue. You argue it in the paperwork. You certainly don't argue it standing on the side of the road. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right.
I mean, these guys, they don't know. They're just regular. Look at this guy's a good guy. He wants to protect and serve. He's not evil. He's a buddy of mine. You know what I mean? And they're telling him when you walk
that, that terminology is not my own. That's what I've heard that the powers that be use against in private conversation with the people that we're talking about, you know.
Well, you know why I know it's close to being over? Because the fact that he told me that and they're telling them that, it means the end is near. Because now that they're telling them that, some of these guys got to go, what the heck are you talking about? That's the crack of light going in. Oh, by the way, when you're walking up to the car, you're contracting with them. Now, some of them will say, oh, cool, okay, let's make a contract and get into it because it's rules of the game. But some of the ones that think a little bit more and say, what do you mean we're contracting with them? They're going to start asking questions. And so it's the beginning of the awakening, You know what I mean? They've gotten to the point that they feel that it's the reason they're telling them that is because they have to tell them that, because we all have made issues about that. You see, they're preparing them to try to get us on these technicalities, right? If it wasn't an issue, they wouldn't be telling them it, right? People must be winning cases with the fact that they were contracted with, through fraud, right? I didn't give them jurisdiction, right? So they must be losing. You don't hear about, everybody says, well, what case did you win? What case, who's winning? Nobody's winning, all this. Well, you don't hear about the win cases because they don't put them on the record. They never let that go through a jury trial. They always give up, give back, you know what I mean? They give you a non-disclosure agreement and they pay you if they have to, because it's worth it for them to pay you to not let it go on the record, because if it ever goes on the record, the word gets out, everybody would do it. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
So that's part of the problem.
Gerard, have you ever heard, now I've heard this within the last 6 months for sure. In fact, I saw something in writing about it, but I don't have it before me. Some judge somewhere came out and stated that administrative courts have been determined to be unconstitutional.
Yeah, I saw it. That's right. Yep.
That's pretty powerful.
It was this past year. Yep. That's true. Well, anyway, John, I want to move on. We got a couple people, and I'm going to try to get through this queue. Thank you very much. Good questions. Good.
Thank you very much.
Yep. Goodbye. Okay. Bye. Let's see here. It looks like California Fred. Go ahead. You've been unmuted, Fred.
Hello, Gerard. Am I too loud or not loud enough?
No, you're pretty good. I mean, maybe you could be a little louder. Go ahead. Talk so I can hear.
Wait one second. I'm adjusting the mic, sir.
That's good right there. That's perfect.
Is that better?
Oh, yeah. That's good.
Okay. I have a few points I'd like to bring up and questions. Number one, statute of limitations. I know there's no statute of limitations on murder, and there's only a statute of limitation on fraud, one calendar year from when you discover the fraud. Are there any other instances like kidnapping? Remember the milk carton children?
Right.
Well, those are open FBI and local cases all over our country. And recently I've seen some YouTube videos on devil worshipers and human sacrifice going through Hollywood and the Supreme Court justices all the way through.
You know, I don't know specifically, but it seems to me that kidnapping is a capital crime. I think you can get the death penalty, can't you, for kidnapping?
That wasn't my question. The question was statute of limitations.
Well, what I'm trying to tell you is I would think there's no statute of limitations on kidnapping. None.
Well, that's a legal question that needs to be answered, because...
Okay, I'm going to tell you what I know legally. That there was an incident that I was involved in with a minor that was with a boy, and she was underage. The boy was of age. And the police officer said, look, you can press charges if you want. He said, do you want me just to scare him? He said, but there's no statute of limitations on this. You can bring it up at any time. So in that, you know, improper contact with a minor, he's telling me that I can come in any time and I can press that issue. And that's
all
in
right,
New York
that
State.
Be...
That's in New York State. So, that gives you an indication of
that
something,
was stat-
I guess.
That would be statutory rape. The same thing is happening.
Right, it would be statutory rape. You're exactly right. And he said there is no statute of limitations. If I wanted to press the charges because she was a minor, I don't want to press the charges, because what I want to do is hold it over him so he doesn't come around. He'll be afraid of me making the phone call, right? You know what I'm saying?
I got it, but my question was, maybe this is something Brent should answer, is to create a list of different crimes that we can charge these people with that have no statute of limitations. So when the dominoes start falling, we have our ammunition ready.
Right. Well, Brent is certainly more qualified to answer that than I am. He's been in the federal courts, and he certainly has more legal knowledge on that than I do. I don't know if he's still on or whatever.
Oh,
but,
I'm here, John. I'm here. I'm here. Can you hear me?
If you want to take a stab.
Yes. Well, just to make a point.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say that point. You said the same thing, Gerard. You said in New York, every state has a different set of statute of limitations, and statute of limitations are all arbitrary or a matter of convenience, where the state legislature just says, look, beyond this point, beyond this many years, we don't believe you can get a fair trial in a situation like this. Witnesses die, evidence gets old and lost, and people forget, and so we're just going to draw a line, and that's it. And statute of limitations are strictly construed. But I agree pretty much substantially with you, Gerard, when it comes to crimes, especially those heavy-duty crimes like kidnapping, murder, rape, the statute of limitations doesn't exist. You can, like you said, you can press them and use them to your advantage that way if you want. But the question more particularly was, is that something, your question was, can that be used to go after people in government that break the law? Is that what you're asking?
Sir, that was part of it, but the milk carton kids, you remember from the 70s?
Yeah, most of those, by the way, back at that time, a lot of those were parents, not people that were trafficking in children. They just wanted their children were wrongly taken from them, or they thought they were, by the courts, and they go and kidnap them. And I have known of people that have gone to different states and even hired people to help them to kidnap their children and bring them back because their spouse left the state when the court ordered them not to, and so they went and got their children. Now there are federal laws in place that make it a high crime to do something like that. And so if you go around chasing your children, try to get them back, you could go to jail for a long time under federal law because crossing state lines brings it into the jurisdiction of the federal courts. But the federal statute of limitations are different. For example, the limitations on the tax code, signing a false tax return is not true and correct as to every material matter. It's a crime. It's a perjury kind of a crime, but the statute of limitations is 6 years. 6 years. That's not a really bad, ugly crime like murder and kidnapping, so it's not wide open. There is a limit beyond which the Congress says the IRS can, the Justice Department can't go and prosecute and things like that. That's good news for some people that file tax returns. But to go after people in government that have committed crimes, and some of them committed some awful crimes, we're watching, we're reading the emails of the awful crimes, the high crimes that are being committed by those that are running and working with those running for president of the United States. That's all there. And the question is, who are you going to get to prosecute these people? Because the Justice Department apparently is often wrapped up. The FBI is part of the crime, like the fellow that said of Hillary, well, yeah, looks like she's guilty, but we're not going to do anything about it. Of course, what they didn't tell you in that particular case was that the FBI doesn't have the power to prosecute anybody. The FBI is just a cadre of low-level clerks, ignorant clerks that are by law bound to not have any discretion at all. So that's, by the way, why they put him up to say that we're not going to do anything about it. He didn't have any power to do anything about it to start with. It's the Justice Department that has the power to do something about it, that makes the decision. The Attorney General of the United States makes the decision whether or not to indict and prosecute people in federal court for crimes. And by the way, the Attorney General of the United States will traditionally has always signed off on every prosecution, every one. So what's the chance of going after somebody in federal office that works in the same government department, gets a paycheck from the same people that the FBI and the Justice Department all of them get their paychecks from,
what's the chance of those folks prosecuting themselves? The criminals are not going to prosecute the criminals. They're all buddies. They're all one big happy family. They work together, and they protect each other. Is that normal? Of course it's normal. It's called paternalism. We all do it. We want to protect our own families, our own friends, the people we have comradeship with, or we work at the same place. That's to be expected. But it doesn't make it right, and it doesn't make it lawful. But then the question comes, what are you going to do about it? You going to prosecute them? No, we can't prosecute them. You can bring a civil rights action against them, but as I like to say, and as that is said among lawyers, there's only one thing that a federal judge hates worse than a civil rights case, and that's a civil rights attorney that brings the case. You won't get very far with that. I haven't heard of a civil rights attorney get much anywhere. And even if they win the case and win all the appeals, then how do you collect the money? How do you get satisfaction? I know of one case where that happened not too many years ago, and it was right at 30 years, 30 years, suing the government in a civil rights action before they collected the money. People don't want to waste their lives doing that, and the federal government knows that. That's why they do what they do. But as a practical matter, there's got to be another remedy than taking government employees in the court. I know there are exceptions, and it has worked sometimes and will work. But these folks don't know that are working in the federal government. They live, they're awash in a culture of lies and deceit and fantasy and stage acting. They don't have a clue right from wrong. I don't say that in jest, and I don't say that as a pejorative statement. When you work for an outfit like the federal government, and it leads down into the state governments, you live in constant, never-ending fantasy, and your paycheck keeps coming no matter what you do. You just join the club, and you'll be okay, and you live the fantasy, and you never get out of it. And they're not going to do something to jeopardize their fantasy world. They've created. They have the power to create their own world. They create it, and then they want to live in it and be comfortable. If you want to come and join them, you can do that too. Take their welfare benefits, their Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, student loans, whatever they offer. Take it. And then you can be part of the club, too. Trouble is, what you don't know is that in the end, if you make a deal with the devil's evil empire, sooner or later, he's going to ask you to pony up what you owe him. And that's what will happen to them. They don't understand that the evil empire and all the minions in it, the useful idiots for the evil empire, eat their own constantly. They never stop. So joining them, it isn't, if you can't beat them, join them. That's not really true. The only safety you have, I say, the only safety any of us have to beat this lawlessness is law. It is the only possible safety, is that we abide by the law, and we insist they do, and we use every tool at our disposal. But again, bringing to justice people in the federal courts is something we're going to have to wait on God for. If we try to do it ourselves, nothing wrong with trying it. Nothing wrong with trying to scare. I've done that. I've gone to federal court. I've filed massive lawsuits against, we scare the daylights out of them. If there's anything they're scared of, it's losing their job and their security. And that does scare them. You tell them, well, you can either do this or you can tell a federal judge why you're not going to do it. I've had to say that before to people. It does bother them. Sometimes it gets them off the dime. But in the final analysis, the federal judges hate those kind of cases. That's been my experience, and you won't get very far with them. As a private prosecutor, civil rights action, for example, Bivens, all that, you won't get very far. I know people that practiced in the federal courts that have just flat quit. So I'm not doing this anymore. And I know others, lawyers that have been disbarred from the federal courts. They practiced in state court, but federal courts said, get out of here. You're not coming in this court anymore. You make life miserable for us. We don't like that. Well, that's where we are, friends, neighbors, and kin. And the question is, what are we going to do about it? And I do believe that I've come to the conclusion that committeemen and committees of safety, properly understood, are a good start into what we need to do is prepare ourselves for what could happen. And the way to do that is make sure you take care of yourself. We talked about it a while ago. We do have sanction. We have sanction and warrant. That means authority from God himself. We needn't be shy about taking care of ourselves. And that means to protect yourself. And that's not, by the way, John called in from Alaska. John, I know that you and I have talked before. And I'm trying to, because I recognize your voice, and I know that maybe it was up there, and maybe it was over the telephone, or maybe both. I think I was up there and talked to you, and I remember some of our conversations. But we do have authority from God, and that should be a great motivation to us. He empowers us to do right. And without him, we don't even have the option of following his standards. We may do it on the outside, but we're doing it for the wrong reasons, and nothing will come of it. So it is important that we do, as those that founded our country, the rank-and-file Americans, I like to call them, the founding fathers were nothing more than men just like them that were echoing what they knew the public believed so they could maintain their influence. Now, many of them believed it, too. I understand that. But understand it was the American that we never hear about, the Americans that made this happen. And they, to a man and a woman, gave homage to the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God. And, John, you put it this way, if you're still listening, you said it's a matter of common sensibilities or common sense. We know. That's right. I think we do. I believe it's written in the nature. No. It's unwritten in the nature of things, but it's revealed that it is right that a man take care of himself and take care of his family. And without that warrant from God, and that's the warrant that they had, and they understood when the country started, that's what motivated them. There has to be that spark on the inside, that drive that just says, no, I don't need to be belligerent, but I'm not budging. I know what's right, and I want to live with myself. I want my pillow to lay easy at night, and I want to have a better report of myself among my family, my children, and my grandchildren. I want them to know, and I want to be an encouragement to them. I want them to know that I didn't budge because I had warrant from God. God told me. He tells you unwritten in the nature of things, revealed, and written particularly. Particularly, we have written warrant, written authority for what we want to do. And it is our duty to defend our jurisdiction individually. Individually, I've been given life. It's a gift. I've been given life. And to not protect my own life is to despise the gift and the giver. Same thing with family, wife, children, friends, neighbors, relatives. They're gifts, all of them. And to not protect your gifts and the jurisdiction that comes with them is to despise the gift, is to hate the gift, is to not love the gift, and to despise and demean the giver. And that's, by the way, breaking the law of God. You'll never get away with that either. So let's get a clue what's going on here. I'm encouraged to do this. And when I talk to you, I get more encouragement. When I look at the laws of nature, the laws of nature is God, I'm encouraged and I'm built up. And if I can pass any of that along, I want to. And you sure all are an encouragement to me also. It's not easy. It's very difficult to face the roaring and the vicious evil of the evil empire. And many of you that I've talked to have told me that you've done that, and you've told me your stories, and I understand some of them. I won't mention names. Outside of John, I mentioned his, but to mention names and talk about experiences people had, there's some people who've called it tonight that have had some really, really tough experiences, and I'm aware of some of them. Those will make you stronger and make you more determined and take the fear out of your gullet. So when you face these creatures that want to be vicious just for the sake of being vicious, wants to shed blood just for the sake of shedding blood, as the Bible says, they can't even rest at night. They can't even sleep until they've accomplished their shedding of blood. That's the people holding the levers of power in America. And locally is the answer. Tip O'Neill didn't agree with his politics at all. But he wasn't dumb, and people in the evil empire aren't dumb. He said all politics is local. He's right. That's true also that all government is local. It starts with you. Can you control your tongue? Can you say the right things when you're supposed to say it? Can you keep your mouth shut when you're supposed to keep your mouth shut when God would have you keep your mouth shut? Do you know his law well enough to know the difference and discern the difference? Have you looked at it? Do you contemplate it? Do you ruminate it? Do you chew it like cud? Do you worry over it like a bone? You must to be free. You cannot be free outside the law of God. It's impossible. the laws of nature are the laws of nature's God, and that's what James tells us. He says this is the law of freedom. There is no freedom outside of the giver of law, the only lawgiver. Well, are you still there, Gerard? It's not past midnight, is it?
No, it's not. No.
Oh, okay.
We got a half hour. We got lots of time.
Oh, okay. Well,
I'm still here.
Look at you got my juices flowing there, Brett. I want to just say something. I'm sorry.
I want to say something first.
Okay,
I'm
go ahead.
Still here too. Brent, sir, have you ever thought of the Pledge of Allegiance, suing in the name of the Republic for which the United States stands, one nation under God, close to Cor Rwanda?
What's that?
Suing in the name of the Republic for which that government stands. Because, obviously, the Pledge of Allegiance supersedes any fiction they might have out there, because that's their house of cards. I think that's the big chink.
Yeah, I'm loath to hold up the Pledge of Allegiance as any kind of a standard. It was written by a fellow named Bellamy who certainly didn't have my point of view about government or God. He had a contrary point of view. And the words of that allegiance, if you parse them, you close and look at them, you say, wait a minute. There's something wrong here. And there is. There's something wrong there. Well, that might be my position on that. I wouldn't hold it up as a standard. Although, I see what you're saying. I don't mean to be critical of you. I'm just saying the Pledge of Allegiance was, it's not the organic law of the United States. I'll just leave it at that. And it's just a hodgepodge of words that are thrown together. And without a lot of thought, a lot of clear thinking, as a matter of fact, with some wrong thinking, and the Republic for which it stands, where does that come from? Where in our Constitution? Well, maybe I'm missing something. Maybe I just can't see it. Is there some place in our organic law where it says the government of the United States is a republic?
It's my understanding that we are a constitutional republic.
People say that. Yeah, I've always been told that too, but I've come to the conclusion it's untrue. It's untrue. And the reason it's untrue is because our Constitution doesn't say it that way. All my life that's been pounded into me. I like to say this: France, under Napoleon, under tyranny, called itself a republic. China, the communist country of China, calls itself republic. The USSR was the United Soviet Socialist Republic. Well, they were republic, and there was no difference. The people that gave us these ideas, these false ideas of democracy and republicanism, made no distinction between a republic and a democracy. That's where the Greeks of the city-states, the great Greek writers, wrote of republicanism and democracy in the same breath, the same sentence. It's all the same thing to them. They're strong synonyms. And I do know that we have the word republic in our Constitution, where it says that every state, the federal government, shall guarantee every state a republican form of government. Republican form of government. And the republican form of government means this. That means that you send representatives to Congress. And beyond that, our Supreme Court has said the federal government has no part in the matter to inquire of anything. The bottom line is, when we say, for example, we are a constitutional republic, that gives all the wrong signals. A lot of countries in the world have written constitutions. But what they don't have is our common law. They don't have that. And our Constitution is a brief of common law government informed and fleshed out and made alive with breath breathed into it by our common law. We are not a constitutional republic. This is my position. This is my position. We are a common law country, period. We're just a common law country. And the common law has certain aspects to it that are very important. One of them is, as Fortescue pointed out in the 15th century, when he was comparing common law with the Roman civil law of France, he said, we have in our republic, in our, here I am talking that way. See, those words have overwhelmed me too. You change words. And it'll change your thinking. And that was the idea when the words democracy and republic. See, people now said, oh, we're not a democracy. We're a republic. That's been the popular thing to say in conservative circles. Well, that's just more doublespeak. And they've got us now saying that. And it's no different. all that says is Congress can do anything they want. Congress is king. Then that's what republicanism will get us. It's just another form of 51% gets to destroy the other 49% of people and have no respect for them. That's what we have. Well, when we have a common law government, the foundation then isn't a majority principle. The foundation becomes the decision of the jury in individual instances because justice can only occur case by case in individual instances. There is no such thing as corporate justice. That's why the evil empire wants to get us all thinking in terms of corporatism now. And if they can do that, then there's no more individualism. They've got to destroy justice, because to destroy justice is to destroy individual justice. That's the only kind there is. There is no corporate justice. There's no such thing as justice for union members in large, justice for corporations, that's all associations, churches even. No, justice is an individual matter, just as salvation is an individual matter. Salvation, what is salvation? Simple word, safety. Just means you're safe. You're made safe. And if you're made safe, justice has been done. That's justice. It only has meaning on the individual level. And juries only have power in individual cases, speaking about individual parties. And so let's be careful. Republicanism means this. John Fortescue, I told you about him. I said he made this distinction, he noticed this this component of common law government. He called it the popular component. He said it's a dangerous component, but it has to be there. What is that? That means you send representatives to give advice and consent to the chief executive. I talked about it a while ago. We were talking about the Witan among the Anglo-Saxons. They used to call it the Thing, T-H-I-N-G. In Norway, they called it the Thang. In some other Nordic countries, they called it the Thung. That's where we get our word Thing. That was the jury, or sometimes the elders. It was the ruling body convened, but it wasn't a majority body. As I said, even the Senate, there's no rule in the Senate of the United States that says in order to seat a judge or give their consent, they have to have a majority. That's a tradition that we follow closely, but we are not a people fundamentally that operate on a majority. If we're a majority rule people, that means republicanism or democracy. Now, isn't it funny? We even have political parties. We name them Republican, Democrat. Well, that just keeps the two branches of the same madness going. That it puts ideas in people's head that we're some kind of a majority rule country. If we don't get that out of our heads and don't get focused on the jury and don't get focused on the local courthouse, and we keep focusing on the White House and the state house, all that, we're not going to have justice, because justice occurs in small things. Despise not small things. That's where it is. The discussions we're having seem small, but they're not small. Most people don't know about our discussions here, but these are big discussions, because we're exchanging. You're telling me things, and I'm picking up ideas, and I'm throwing ideas back at you, and we're building. We're building in our heads. We're putting ideas in soil. If there's anything the evil empire fears, I mean, they tremble from things like this. So this is my suggestion, that we concentrate more on the jury, and we get the word republicanism and republic and democracy out of our vocabulary, and don't talk in those terms unless we have to speak about the guarantee clause of our Constitution, where it talks about a republican form of government.
So I'll there is one nation.
Go ahead. I'm listening.
One nation under God then would be what you'd sue under.
Well, yeah, probably.
Okay, it's my turn now.
Okay, go ahead.
You kind of went where I was going to go in response to John's suit, class action suit. Look, what we're working for is the common law grand jury. Now, the common law grand jury operates on a local level on a case-by-case basis. If we can institute where the people have control over their courts, it would be control over their public officials through the juries and the grand juries. That's where it's going to fix it. And each one is going to do it. You don't need to do a big scheme across the whole country, just like you're right. And once we get our juries and grand juries back in place, look at everybody else is going to fall into place. These guys that are doing what they're doing, you're going to see how fast they turn into choir boys when they realize that the people are loose. that there's a common, there's a runaway common law grand jury coming to town. So I think you're right that, you know, we have to institute these committees of safety. We need to be talking. We need to be bringing the common law back into the courts, and the juries have got to be run not by the government but by the people. And that's why how this will get fixed. It'll get fixed on a local level, and that's the best place for it to get fixed, because, you know, look, if you're going to do a class action suit across the nation, what you're talking about is you're talking about going after the big boys that had the ability to hurt everybody, right? The president, all these people that, you know, they're really insignificant because they need the people to stand on. If they didn't have the counties, they wouldn't have a place to put their feet, would they? They wouldn't have any authority. And the only reason they have authority is because we obey them and we give them that authority. We self-police ourselves. When people stand up and say, we're not going to do it anymore, and no, you don't, and this is what it is, and we need our common law grand juries, it's done. It's ended right then and there. So, you know, I guess you kind of went there. I got another, you know, I found a book that's out of print that my mother had from years and years ago, and it was called The Republic. And in it, it explained... It broke the government down, the separation of powers. It was like flow charts, and they went all the way from the president down to the dang dog catcher, showing how the separation of powers in a republic. And it wasn't necessarily a bad thing, because we do have separation of powers, and it kind of showed where the power flowed. But I think we've lost sight of that whole representative government thing. You know what I mean? And when they said, what kind of government do we have? I think it was it Hamilton or Jefferson said, a republic, if you can keep it. That's a story that goes around. Now, I don't know if you got any comment on that, but...
That was Ben Franklin.
Yeah, Ben Franklin. A republic, if you can keep it, remember?
Yeah, and I've come to the conclusion that story is probably apocryphal, in other words, made up, but I don't know. I can't find anything substantiating the story is what I'm saying.
Yeah,
and
so
whether or not,
cool.
Yeah. Well, it could be. I mean, but there's nothing wrong with having a Republican form of government. Matter of fact, as I said, our Constitution guarantees it to every state. When a state, even when the states became states, the ones out west anyway, west of the colonies, they had to put something in place that proved they had established that kind of a Constitution that showed Congress they established that kind of government before they would give that permission to grant statehood type thing. So it's an important part of it, but it's a weak, beggarly part. I mean, let's face it, what good are congressmen? And over the years, they've gotten to have less good. They're not doing their job. State legislators don't do their job. State legislators today don't even have the power to elect U.S. senators. We want to talk. Why is it people? Why is it that people, said one man, smarter than me, he said, why is it that people rattle their chains to proclaim their freedom? Rattle their chains to proclaim their freedom. We are a republic. The Jews in the gospel records, they said, we have never been enslaved any man. And Jesus Christ was there, and he's thinking to himself, no doubt from the context you could see it, these guys are living in la-la land. You've been enslaved to the Egyptians. You've been enslaved to the Babylonians. And as you speak, you're enslaved to Rome. And you're saying we are Abraham's seed and we've never been enslaved anyone. Well, people do that all over the world. We're still doing it in America. We're a free country. We're a free country as our freedoms are slowly being whittled away. And the more they're whittled away, the louder we scream, we're a republic. We're a democracy. We're free. But truth is, we need to be sober. We need to be quiet. And we need to be immovable. And we need to resist. And, of course, somebody's thinking that they're listening. Well, being quiet is not something you're known for, Brent. We noticed that about you. Well, that may be true. I see your point. But we do need to be sober. Right now it's my time to speak. That brings up another thing, talking about juries and the power of juries. You know, juries have a jurisdiction, and they don't have it all the time. And the judge has the right to, with the administration of the court, has the lawful right to make sure the jury gets impaneled and oversee that process. And then he has the duty, that's a good duty, to instruct the jury. And jurors should just be quiet and listen and allow him to do what his role allows him and demands that he do. But once they get in the jury room, it's theirs.
It's their baby. That's their moment of power, and they'd better be using it and not be listening to the judge and not be listening and not be controlled by each other or controlled by the prosecutors. They better do what they want to do, and even if they, all of the what the judge tells them and they decide is wrong, they still got to do right. No man has a right to do wrong. No man has a right to hide behind the authority or the power of another man. So the fellow that said, he was so famous, he said, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, Lord Dalberg Emmerich Acton. He said that. He was a staunch Roman Catholic in the tradition of Mel Gibson and his father. Same organization, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. That was back in the 1850s. He was a fundamental, if there is whatever that means, Roman Catholic. But during that time, the Pope of Rome put out a bull that said it was impossible for him to make a mistake as long as his buttocks was sitting on the throne in the Lateran Council. Once he said, my buns touch that chair, I can't speak untruth. Well, Acton blew a head gasket. He said, that's the craziest thing, the most dangerous thing I've ever heard. And he said this. He said, there is no heresy more dangerous in the world than the heresy that says the office sanctifies the man. The office sanctifies the man. He gets immunity. You can't sue him anymore. He puts on a robe. He puts on a little pin that says he's a United States congressman. He wears a uniform. He carries a gun. The office sanctifies the man. We've never lived in the time we live now. I've even had old lawyers tell me this. You go into court against the government, it ain't like it was 40 years ago. You had a shot. There was a level playing field. That doesn't exist anymore. The office of all these people, we somehow got the idea, sanctifies them from wrong. And so what they do is okay, and the burden's on us to prove otherwise at every level, whether it's criminal or civil. And judges will say in court, I'm just telling you, I'm reporting my experience, well, I'm prone to believe the prosecutor. I'm prone to believe, I'm bound to believe the prosecutor. I have to believe the prosecutor. I've had them say that to me. You have to? You have to believe the prosecutor? Well, yes, the prosecutor's a lawyer and an officer of the court. And until he's proven otherwise, I'm bound to believe him until it's obvious he's not telling the truth. The office does not sanctify the man. I'm quoting Lord Dalberg Emmerich Acton, a staunch Roman Catholic from England who said power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. But I want to drop a footnote from as much as I like to read Acton. He was a smart man and he was a wise fellow, but power never corrupted anybody. He's wrong on that point. Power never corrupted anybody. Indeed, never could corrupt anybody. How do I know? I know because man has already been corrupt from birth. He has a weakness. He is corrupt. And power doesn't corrupt him, but it sure does accent that corruption and give opportunity to its ugly use. So the spirit of what he says is true, but as a particular matter, he's wrong. Power, but he's taking, of course, the position of Rome when he says that. Rome would say that people are not born in corrupt. Whereas the Bible teaches that men are born with that weakness. There's nothing we can do about it. Every one of us, we got it from our father. Well, that's a good place to take a breather, Gerard. Go ahead.
Yeah, that the whole business of the Pope being infallible is a bastardized statement, because what the original statement was is that the Pope could speak no error when he was speaking ex cathedrally from the chair. Well, that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. He can't speak error when he's speaking on matters of faith and morals. Well, what's matters of faith and morals? That's the Ten Commandments. That's the Ten. How could he err on the Ten Commandments? Everybody would catch his butt. You know what I mean? So, yeah, he would never err on faith and morals when he's speaking ex-cathedrally from the chair. Well, of course, like you say, power, absolute power, these guys, just like the government, they always want more power than they're given. And so he's a man, and he's just like you and me. He's got two arms, two legs, one head, and he's subject to all those temptations that we're subject to, and even more so. And at that time, I don't remember who it was, but I think the church considered him a saint. He said, listen, the floor of hell is littered with the skulls of popes and bishops. So, you know, and I'm a Catholic, so I can say that. But anyway, that's besides the point. Okay.
Well, we've taken that doctrine now and transferred it over to just government in general. And, of course, he is that particular fellow you're talking about, he fills an office of government. It's a government, and they have their own sovereign place there, and the United States recognizes it as a country. But that idea of ex cathedra, I didn't know how to pronounce it, ex cathedra, from the chair, it now encompasses, in principle, governments everywhere. Really, it always has, especially in governments of the law of the city. You know, the whole idea of divine right of kings, that's what we fought when our country started. The idea that kings are fathers to the people of their country, that's a Roman civil law doctrine. And they can do no wrong, and they enter no man on earth. That's the doctrine. Well, that is spread because then the employees of the bureaucracies of government, they somehow get subsumed in that doctrine that they can do no wrong because they're working for their boss. And as a matter of law, a bureaucrat has no wiggle room to have any discretion. He has to do exactly what the regulations tell him. Of course, we know that's not really true, but that's the theory. Well, if that's true, then he can do no wrong either. He's doing what he's told. But in our common law country, that's not the fundamental doctrine. The fundamental doctrine here is that no man can be shielded from criminal liability by claiming he obeyed the government. And that's what bureaucrats are doing. The office sanctifies the man. I like the way Acton put it, because it's just a short, terse statement that gets the point. There is no doctrine so dangerous as the doctrine that says the office sanctifies the man. He called it a heresy, and that's where we are. So we need to, it's up to us to make sure, and one way to do that is for us to fulfill the two duties of the militia, of militiamen. The two duties of militiamen, one stressing the foreign responsibility against foreign enemies and the other against domestic enemies. Against domestic enemies, the power of the jurymen, grand jury and petit jury, and against foreign enemies, armed defense as a member of the militia of the states. And it is a duty of every militiaman to see that he is armed and at his own expense, and that he is trained to safety and marksmanship in handling and wielding that weapon called a rifle or a pistol or both. I'm taking a breather, John. Gerard, I'm sorry. Gerard.
We got 3 minutes to midnight.
Well,
is Gerard gone?
No, he's there. I'm gonna mute out now, let someone else that might have a question.
Okay, like Cam says, thank you, Brett. Thank you, Fred. And we have 3 minutes till midnight, so I don't know, maybe we'll take one more, and then we'll end. Kansas Jan, you've been unmuted. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just was, I'm really glad that Brent addressed that we're not Republican form or Democratic form, but that we are a common law form of government, because I think we all, I'm kind of new to this, and a lot of us are, but we, not tonight, because I think we're all like, we got our heads stuffed full tonight, but Brent, if you would address sometime coming up, whether or not that we Americans are under the rule by consent rather than rule of law, because it's my imperfect understanding that the rule of law has something to do with canon law, canon meaning rule, and then that puts us in with the Roman civil law again, whereas our Declaration of Independence and our preamble and our Bill of Rights in particular are the three documents or portions of documents that say, no, we're not ruled by rule of law, we're ruled by consent. And see, then, this is my final thought on that tonight, is that then if we are ruled by consent, then that puts us right back to what you were explaining tonight, Brent, about the common law form of government being an individual trial by jury, just like salvation. And I mean, it just, you really put the puzzle pieces together tonight for me, but on that. But if you would at some time in the future talk about whether we are ruled by rule of consent in the common law form of government, I would appreciate it very much.
Well, we are, we're under consent because of the jury, especially. There are other ways too, but the jury, its only job is to say yes to the government or to say no. Yes, you may try this man for this crime. That's the grand jury's job. Or no, you may not try this man for a crime. And then the petit jury is by consent. The petit jury says, yes, you may take this man's life, liberty, or property, or any combination thereof. Or no, you may not. So there's the fundamental consent. Again, coming back to the jury, there are other elements of our government that have this element of consent. One other thing I wanted to say, we aren't, strictly speaking, I agree, a Republican form of government, but there is a Republican-Democratic element, I guess is what you'd call it. In other words, where we use majorities sometimes, I mean, even in our presidential elections, we use majorities, but that's still subject to the electors. We're very careful about that. Democracy is something that would have, it made our founders tremble. They saw the evils of it, because once the majority gets control, the other people just don't matter at all. And that's why the legislative branch of our government is a dangerous branch. Now, we've come a step further than even England. England has, Britain, I should say, at this point, since 1701 or whenever it was when they joined with Scotland. But the Parliament in England is utterly sovereign, utterly. No power on earth, it said, can upstage Parliament. And that is true. Although, as a practical matter, because they are a common law country, there is a lot of whittling away at that happens that they don't talk about when they make that statement. But in America, we have done something different. Of the three branches of government we have, legislative, that's Congress, judicial, that's the Supreme Court, and the other courts that Congress establishes, and executive, the office of president, none of those three powers have trumping power over any of the other two. They are co-equal. They're not bound to obey each other. Nothing in our law says they should. But we are a government of consent. That's a common law government. Separation of powers, co-equal branches. That's the old Anglo-Saxon 1,000-year-ago tradition. But
what you were saying then too about the juries, the grand and petit juries, and rule by consent through the jury, that includes jury nullification too, because that's also a form of consent. It's just really exciting, you know, to realize that we have more say about things than what we've been told we do.
Well, that's a fact. Now, the question of canon or the rule of law, you can go read the books about rule of law, all the definitions in the dictionaries, and you'll still come away. If you don't come away a little confused, you haven't read everything. The scholars, the fellows that are supposed to know or supposed to instruct us about what that is, can't come to a solid conclusion. Of course, in a common law country, we listen to the court opinions more than anything. We should. That's what's going to dictate what will happen. And there are many aspects. When I say aspects, I mean many faces, like a diamond to the idea, rule of law. And it's like trying to define our common law. I like to say it's just a way of life. That's what it is, a way of life and thinking. You can't, it's due process, most fundamentally, all that's true. But to say, here's our common law, it's a list of laws and here they are. No, that won't work. Same thing is true with the phrase rule of law. The phrase rule of law is what the court's attempts, judges' attempts, the appellate courts especially, to try to put in a short phrase one of the fundamentals of America, and the rule of law is one of those fundamentals. It means many different things, no sense going over them now. But it means, among other things, that there is one law here, and everybody's subject to it. I was just reading recently. Well, I'm not reading. I was going through Magna Carta. I'd done reading to do that. That's been last year. I expounded Magna Carta. You can get a lot of that. I need to put that up on my website. I think it was about 30 hours a lecture. But going through Magna Carta, you begin to see Yeah, that was the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta last year is the reason I did it. It worked out good. But there is one law. The Bible says, and this is following the precedent of God, that God said when he gave his pattern for government for a nation, he said, there's just one law here. You can't have people in this nation, one group of people having this law, another group having that, and on and on and on. But in common law England, and the jury that had that, and Israel too, in common law England, during the days of Magna Carta, and Magna Carta references this, as to trial by jury, there were three classes of people. There were Welshmen, there were Jews, there were merchants, and then there were, I say four, and then there were Englishmen. Four classes, Welshmen, Jews, merchants from foreign countries, and Englishmen. Every one of those groups, even though the law was the same in all of England, but with the jury, every one of those groups was entitled to a different jury. The Welshman was entitled under Magna Carta to a jury of Welshmen. The Jew was entitled to a jury of Jews. And the merchant from a foreign country was entitled to what they called the jury of the half tongue. That means half of the people on the jury were speakers of English as primary language, and half of the people on the jury were speakers of as a primary language of another country. And they said, this is the only way we're going to fulfill this peer, trial by a jury of your peers, is if we let people sit in judgment on their own kind. But, they said, there's still just one law that the jury is to deal with. Well, the same thing is true in America. The rule of law says this, like it says in the Bible. There shall be one law among you. One law for the stranger, as one law for the natural born, one law for the foreign born. They had words for all those. By the way, in the Bible, in the old translations and the new ones, the word stranger covers four words, four Hebrew words. And each one of them has a different meaning. One means denizen. One means a stranger you don't want there. Another means a stranger you do want there because he's a friendly stranger. You'd like him to live there. And then they have a word for a person who is not natural born, just like we're arguing today about Obama not being natural born. They have a word for that. And the one that wasn't natural born wasn't allowed to be a leader and hold a position of headship in the nation. That's the same thing our Constitution says. You must be natural born. You see, there's a connection between the law of God written in the Bible and the law of God, or the law under the common law of our Constitution. But the canon law, and the word canon is a word that meant, it was a word in Latin, it's a Latin word, it's all of the canon law anymore, but the word meant a reed, and a flag, a cattail kind of a thing, a papyri that came out of the reeds of Egypt, and the word, they called that a canon, kanon, and they cut it to a certain length, like a yardstick, and make yardsticks out of it, only they didn't use yards, they used forearms and cubits and things, but they cut those, and so when they say, when the old word for the law, the Roman law, is canon law, it is the measurement, it is the standard for all things. It is the logos. They called it the same thing that the Apostle John calls Jesus Christ, the logos, the word, translated the word. So they had a view of their law, Roman law did, and the Roman church, that is higher than the Bible. And even yet today, Roman priests are Roman lawyers of the canon law. The Bible is not their book for faith and practice. The law of Rome is their book. And they know it very well. And they're highly educated people, hold education in high esteem. But that doesn't mean that they're following the right standard. But that's the purpose or the meaning of the word canon when they say canon law. It's a standard. It's a word that means standard, a yardstick law, a law that's supposed to be the yardstick to all other laws. But that has no relationship. That word canon has no relationship to our common law. But there's more confusion because you go to the Bible, and even Christian theologians today say that the Bible is a canon. That means that it's a measuring stick. Well, that's a Latin word that, like most Latin words, gives a false idea of truth because we're not Latin-speaking people. So we just need to use English and say that it's a yardstick and let it go with that. But that's the confusion of mixing languages and words, again, like law. You start using more than one, pretty soon you start attaching meanings from the canon law of Rome when you're using those words into your common law, and that's been a problem. And by the way, that's what's happened to our church since the days of the Reformation. We're still using those old Latin words, and it's causing great confusion because those words freight in with them the meanings that the scholastics gave them. And so we get off kilter because words are big. Words are everything. They're not some things. Well, I know, Gerard, we're now over midnight, aren't we? Maybe I was talking to myself.
No, I'm here.
Oh, you're okay. Well, maybe it's just you and I. But I know it's past midnight. Gerard, did you drop out?
I'm still here, California Fred.
Oh, California Fred. Well, good to hear from you, California Fred. Well, you know, the funny thing is, I'm not part of the leadership in this organization, so when I come on, I'm not privy to the technical aspects of how to put people on, put people off. And if Gerard drops out, I don't know how to do anything but just quit talking and hang up. And so if Gerard's not here...
He's probably muted.
Yeah.
Hit the mute button, Gerard.
If he isn't, I'm going to hang up, and I'd encourage others to do the same. Thanks a lot. I'll say this. I don't always stay this late, but since John wasn't here, I enjoy it very much, chatting with everybody and hearing what people are thinking. And because you folks matter, and your ideas matter, and I learn a lot listening. And then when I talk, I learn more because of the things you mention and what you ask, so I appreciate it all. And I'm going to take my phone and hang up unless there's a vol. If everyone's at peace, so.
Well, could you answer one more question, Brent?
Gerard, just a minute. I will. Is Gerard there?
Yeah, I'm here. No. I'm back.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. You caught me.
Well,
I ran into the little boy's room, but you caught me.
Oh, I got you.
I just wanted to know, what's that version of the Bible that you said is the best one, besides yours, of course? But what was the version from, like, 600 years ago that you said is the best one?
Well, there's just good ones. I'm loath to say this one's the best, or some I like for different reasons. Once you know why the Bible was translated, the particular version, then you can deal with it. You can help. For example, the King James Bible was translated to support the idea of divine right of kings. Now, that doesn't mean it's all bad. I mean, they were very good. These guys were good linguists, and they did a bang-up job. Beautiful language. As you know, it's the pinnacle of the English-speaking world. But nonetheless, as I go through it, I can see that they were supporters of the divine right of king doctrine. As a matter of fact, you couldn't be on the translation team unless you swore to that before King James. You had to support that doctrine. But that Bible was translated to undo the effects of the Geneva Bible, and that's probably the one you're talking about. The Geneva Bible was translated in the city of Geneva by Scottish and Englishmen and Scotsmen, English-speaking people, exiled, to keep from getting their heads cut off, exiled into the city of Geneva, and they lived there, and there was an English-speaking congregation there. And during that time, the men that led that congregation, there were quite a few of them, they were able men, and they translated the Bible into English. And they did it in denial of the divine rights of king doctrine. And it was the first study Bible ever printed in English. They had footnotes and annotations, and then you can still get that Bible. And I imagine that's the one you talked about. And I have to say, that Bible's a good Bible. The King James is a good Bible, but it doesn't make some of the distinctions I wish it made. I'd mentioned some of them. One English word will do the work of 12, 15 Hebrew words sometimes. They don't distinguish synonyms that well. They just wanted to get the Bible out. And here's the thing they didn't have in those days that we do have today. They didn't have computers. And it was almost impossible to catalog every Hebrew and Greek and Aramaic root and then go through and try to have a consistency of English translation. So I'm not criticizing them, but every person, the Geneva Bible, and you can find it under the name Geneva Bible. You can buy the original printing, a facsimile of the original printing, or you can buy a printing that's been done recently of the Geneva Bible. Then the King James Bible, and then the Bible that I like, that I think is a good one, more modernly, is the New American Standard Bible of the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. But some people complain because they use the wrong Greek manuscripts, and I understand their point. There are some things missing out of that Bible, some words that are missing, but it doesn't. The overall message isn't destroyed. I don't go as far as some people and say that. But and I did know some of the people who are on that translation team. Some of them are gone now, they're getting old, and their names have never been published. But they were sincere men who wanted to do the right thing. I know that about them. I don't agree with all their points of view, but nobody ever does. That's what this is, America. We can take our Bibles and decide for ourselves. That's why we're strong, by the way, in my humble opinion, and have been in the past. But the Geneva Bible is probably the one you were talking about.
I think that is. Thank you, Brent. That sounds like it.
Good talking to you.
Thanks.
Okay, folks. Thanks a lot. It was a good call. I'm gonna end it now.
Thanks, Gerard. Night.
Yeah.
Night.
Okay, good
night. Night.
I'll leave. Go ahead.